I want to call the meeting of the Board of Technical Registration to order. Ms. Lucero, can we please do a roll call?
Dr. Alejandro?
Here.
Jack Gilmore?
Here.
Neil Jones?
Here.
Jason Foos?
Here.
Jason Madison?
Yep.
Carmen Whitehawk?
Here.
Stephen Noah?
Here.
Andrew Everett?
Here.
Eugene Montgomery?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. We'll do the call to the public first. Members of the public may address the board during this call for no more than 3 minutes. Board members are not allowed to discuss or take legal actions on matters raised during the open call to the public unless they're properly noticed for discussion and legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. So with that, is anybody here, would anybody like to address the board on an item that's not on the agenda? Okay. Nobody wanted to speak. We will go to item 4A, adoption of minutes. And so first, the meeting minutes of the October 23rd board meeting. And everybody, I think, has a hard copy of them with you.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the meeting notes of October 23rd meeting.
Okay, so we have a motion from Mr. Noel with second from Mr. Gilmer. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Next, we will look to approve, modify, or reject the minutes from the October 26th board meeting.
It's a minor thing, but I was not going to add one.
On the 26th?
Also allow
science
accept this
Singed
agreement.
What was that, Patty?
Singed.
They could have felt three in the last sentence.
It was Singed.
Okay. So it looks like a couple of corrections. One, Ms. Wyckoff not being here, and two, just a clerical error, one of the sentences?
Right.
Okay.
I move we accept the minutes with those changes as noted.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
I'll second that, Chair.
Okay. We have a motion from Mr. Foos with a second from Mr. Gilmore. Is everybody in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Recuse.
You weren't here. Okay. Thank you. So we approve them with those two changes. Okay. We have a couple of cases that I think we need to take up first because Mr. Hunt has a conflict. So we'll start with those. First case will be 6D2. Mr. Hunt, if you would come up. And I don't believe anybody's here for this item. Is there anyone here for this item? This is P18047. Respondent is Cesar Armenta, Matrix Architecture, LLC. And this is in reference to Kearney City Atwood Upon Tenant Improvement Project on Grand Avenue in El Mirage. The synopsis of the complaint is that there was an allegation that the respondent fraudulently applied the seal and signature of Roger Plate to a set of plans for tenant improvements in a commercial project. I think the finding was that Mr. Armenta did not apply the seal, but was aware that his name and respondent firm were on the plans, and he's also not registered, and neither is his firm. Correct. Is that correct, Mr. Hunt?
Yes.
Anything else to add for the board on this, or?
No, I thought he was going to be here today. He actually said he was going to sign, but all the details are in the report. If it gets convoluted for you, I'd be happy to explain.
Okay, and staff recommendation is assurance of discontinuance, penalty of $1,000, and $442 in cost of investigation.
Yeah.
So it sounds like he used his title sheet. His title sheet said Matrix Architecture on it, and that's what triggered this?
Well, I think the what triggered it was Mr. Plate found out about the project and really was complaining that his seal was being used.
Yeah.
About Mr. Armenta was using it. Kind of a lot of back and forth. As it turns out, it was Mr. Escalante, who we've seen here already, was doing it. They were in a partnership doing projects. Mr. Armenta did change his firm name with the Corporation Commission and his website as soon as he got the notice of investigation. But he was aware that his name was on the plans and the firm name because we went back and forth with the plans. We got the original plan from Mr. Escalante that had been sent to Mr. Armenta via email and to verify that his name and firm name were on there. So he was saying he didn't even know, but he did.
Is there any additional action with Mr. Escalante that we're pursuing, or is this all... I mean, I saw in there that it's about the same timeline as another consent we have with him. Did he disclose this issue during that consent agreement?
No. We aren't recommending anything. I mean, we have fined $20,000 previously. And his attorney and he were both very cooperative in assisting us getting information about this case.
And is he in compliance with his consent agreement at this point, Mr. Escalante?
He's getting better, yes.
We'll take it up.
I believe he's out of the country, so his attorney is diligently working to encourage him to stay on top of compliance.
Question, Mr. Hunt. I mean, how did Roger Plate lose control of his seal?
I believe that he... Again, with Mr. Escalante, he had worked with Mr. Plate in the past as an employee, to my understanding. And so, from that partnership, Mr. Escalante utilized Mr. Plate's seal on several projects. This just being one of them.
Is there any additional questions or discussion on this item? Is there a motion on site?
I move we offer the consent agreement as written. If not signed within 30 days, proceed to formal hearing.
Second.
Okay. So we have a motion to offer the consent agreement to Mr. Armenta by Mr. Fu, seconded by Mr. Jones. Let's vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Motion passes. We will now take up case 6F1. This is agenda 6F1 case HI-17031. Respondent is Matthew Jenks. Employer is First Step Home Inspectors, and this is about an inspection on Peoria, Arizona. The update on this case is there was a prior consent agreement with this respondent. The respondent was in compliance with the agreement, but has some concerns about the current rules, which do not allow someone with discipline to within the last 3 years to serve as a payroll inspector. So would you, Mr. Jenks, would you identify yourself for the board, please?
Yeah, good morning. Matthew Jenks with First Step Home Inspectors. And you're absolutely correct. That's the nature of my question.
Okay. Is there, and I think you had a letter in the packet, but is there anything else you'd like to explain sort of to the board on your request?
Sure. When I went through this process, pretty much a year ago today, sat with the board and we went through the finalization of my consent agreement. When the new parallel requirements came out in, I think it was August, early September, which is when I learned of them, I was a little concerned because based on the rules now, I'm not able to do any more parallel training, of which I have been doing a fair amount of, and I wanted to continue doing so. I guess my thought process I understand, of course, the board's position of not wanting people with discipline and having, you know, the 5 years minimum, which I think is a great idea, and the minimum 250 inspections, also I think a great idea. However, in my case, I have been doing a lot of training over the past few years, along with other inspectors. I was in the process of training three other gentlemen who I've since passed on to other inspectors to finish their training. In the past few years, I've been doing this since February 2006 when I got finally licensed. This case that Mr. Hunt was able to help me with was the first time I wasn't able to resolve an issue with the client, you know, face-to-face, and it rarely happens, but, you know, there's always, as I've understood, some you can't handle on your own. This whole process, I believe, has also made me a better inspector, understanding more of the requirements, and it actually made my software better. One of the first things I did when I heard about this was tear it apart, put in the things that were missing, canceled my next day appointments, and, you know, gave them to my guys I was working with, and, you know, made sure this was priority. Of course, I also complied with everything as fast as I could, you know, to make sure everything was done on time and appropriately, which is also very important.
Yeah.
As far as the things I've already done with inspectors, in the past couple of years, 7 of the 10 people I've done have become licensed inspectors and are currently still working. One of them moved to Texas. I don't know if he's doing it out there, but he's not here anymore. 3 more are still in process of finishing, and I would just really like to continue that process. You know, this really was only the bump in the road is appropriate thing to say, but I felt like I handled it quickly, appropriately, with a lot of help from Mr. Hunt to make sure things were handled properly. I've done close to 5,000 inspections. This is the first issue I've had, so the fact I've contributed to the pool already with other licensed inspectors who are doing well, and I really like to continue doing it. I enjoy it. I like it. I have fun doing it. My other job, I was a trainer as well, so I just enjoyed training and contributing. So that kind of was the nature of my question.
Okay.
As if it's possible to still do so.
Thank you, Mr. Jenks. Is there any questions or discussion? I have a question. As I read the rule, it says that a parallel inspector shall be in good standing and not have received disciplinary action within the preceding 3 years. So, I read one, that it's a shall. Two, that it doesn't matter what type of discipline it was. I mean, whether we said that he's already in compliance with all his terms and he's released from his consent agreement, he still received discipline within 3 years. So, I mean, can we legally, as a board, make a change, or is it bound by the rule?
What do you think, Mr. Donald? Do you think the board has the discretion on a case-by-case basis, or are they confined by the shall language in the rule?
R-430-102?
The problem is, as soon as you say shall.
Yeah, it's a rule.
That's the problem, the rule.
It goes on to the next page.
Shall not have received 3 years.
My concern is, I have sympathy for the case, and I understand that the case was not as severe as some of the other cases we've had with home inspectors, and that you're in compliance, which is great. I just don't see any leniency for the board to do anything under the rule.
Right.
If I have a chance, when you're ready.
Yes, absolutely.
And I understand this is an unintended consequence of the agreement. Honestly, a direct read of the rule doesn't seem to leave much room, much legal room for the use of shall. Really doesn't leave a whole lot of room to maneuver.
Does it matter that the agreement was entered upon before the rule was in effect, and maybe that wasn't something he was thinking about when he signed the consent agreement?
Well, situation like this, it's not going to specifically make a difference. There are circumstances where something like that could cause an unintended consequence that I would say legally would be a substantive change that really would be an unintended consequence. But something like this, I don't think would fall into that category. This is the rule set up by the board specifically for parallel health inspectors.
And I think there's a good reason we did it. I mean, the intent is that we only want good inspectors to serve doing parallel inspections so that the new inspectors that come up know what they're doing.
Right. I mean, the problem is the use of shall. The board doesn't really have discretionary language in here to allow for alternate methods of reaching a home inspector being qualified. I don't really think the court has any discretion in this circumstance, legally.
So no wiggle room.
Unfortunately, the way the rule was drafted.
I understand.
That was my only question, was when Mr. Hunt and I talked originally, there's a couple paths to go with the consent agreement. And with the consent agreement, I figured, well, it seemed like the easiest. It seemed, you know, I accepted what I'd done and moved on with it. But had I known, this would be, like you said, an unintended consequence, I probably would have handled it differently because I do a lot of training. But right. That's what I was hoping, since this was handled prior to, that would be
the difference. Yeah.
Wiggle room.
Yeah, and I guess the one thing I would say is that if you hadn't signed the consent agreement, the board would have probably still pursued the case, and if you had ended up with any kind of discipline, you'd still be in the same place. But I understand exactly what you're saying.
Yeah,
that would have weighed in your decision on what to do.
Yes.
Unfortunately, legally, the board really can't enter into consent agreements with the idea being that there might be a change in statute,
the future
rule at a future date that would retroactively apply to every consent agreement. That the board simply isn't set up to go back and retroactively analyze every consent.
Okay.
I noticed that the complaint was a good 7-8 months before the consent agreement. Does it determine whether it's from the date of the consent agreement or the date of the action? Because he would be 8 months closer to doing parallel inspections.
The discipline, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The effective date of the consent agreement, which would be the date signed.
Okay.
Mr. Jenks, I don't think the board can do anything. I mean, I think there is a recourse where you can challenge a rule. Yes. What was that?
I appreciate that.
I think we could be transparent. So if you have an issue with the rule and you think it would make sense, I mean, it's up to you.
I think I'm in the right place understanding it. I understand the nature of rules are there for a reason. My thought process was if it happened prior, maybe there's a way to figure out something I can do. I guess thinking of what I can do to make things better moving forward, is there a reconsideration process for things as a no issue sense, you know, XYZ? Is there a possibility of me doing these sooner? Or is it a hard 3 years? Or
From the board perspective, and after hearing from our AG, we can't do anything based on the current, I don't see any wiggle room for the board. As I said, there's a process by which you can challenge a rule if you think it's overly burdensome to you. That's not with the board. Who is that with? Governor's Regulatory Review Council.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it does. So I guess what I would say is don't expect that it would change within 2 weeks or anything like that. But if you think this is something you want to pursue, you're absolutely welcome to. And I apologize.
Okay, so the case is resolved. It's correct. Just the date from the consent.
And I would like to know, I guess I should ask, since I'm here, the exact date that I signed the agreement. I don't have it with me, but does anybody?
Yeah, we have it. Mm-hmm.
It's like January 16th of 2017.
Okay. So January 16th.
the effective date.
for this year.
2018.
I like these numbers.
It's 17 though on the...
Doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's actually 18.
It's actually 18.
Because she signed it on December 23rd of 2017. It's just...
There you go.
By the time I signed it, it was January, but it was, I said 27.
Yeah, that's what's on the thing.
That's what's on the paper.
So it's on the books.
It's a typo.
That's it. Thanks, guys.
Mr. Jenks, thank you, and sorry we didn't have a better answer for you.
Look at that. That's it.
2017, man. It's good. I didn't remember that.
I was probably on vacation. It wasn't my fault.
But you can run with that now, can't you?
He signed it on December.
Yeah, but it's when Alejandro...
It was Alejandro who signed it in January.
Yeah, blame it on me.
But it's still 2017.
Okay. We'll go to case 6F2, which is P18046. Respondent is Charles Andrews, civil PE. And basically what we have here is respondent signed a consent agreement in August 28th of 2018. And if we want more fun with dates, he completed the requirements in April of 2018, 4 months before signing the agreement.
So active.
Yeah. No, but he is, he's complied all the terms of the agreement, with all the terms of the agreement. Is that correct, Mr. Hunt, at this point?
Yes.
Okay. And what he wants to do is to be released of the agreement at this point. Is there more to his request than just
no.
be...
Because the language in the consent agreement say that he completes all the terms prior to the 20-month, end of the 20-month probation period, he may be eligible for early termination.
Okay.
So that's why he's requesting that.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Andrews is not here? Okay. No. Just as a reminder, I think this was a case in Prescott?
Yeah.
Where there was a street improvement, sort of like a road diet or complete street, where they changed the street quite a bit, narrowed it a lot, put curbs, but did not consider the drainage, so there was a lot of flooding in adjacent properties afterwards. So he met all the terms, which actually were state suspension, a penalty, and the cost of investigation, but there was no requirement for any training or anything of that sort.
I see no reason not to remove the stay on it. The point of the stay is to make sure to comply.
Do we need to come here for
this? Complied, what's the point of having the stay still?
Yeah, that's a good question.
You should come just straight to the director.
I don't remember seeing these in the past. I didn't know if this actually had to come there, was it was more administrative.
That's fine. We're going to talk about a similar issue later on their agenda, so, I mean, if you don't want to see these types of cases, and it's your interpretation, unless Scott feels differently, leaving the decision to end of probation and close a compliance case, do you think that's something the director could do if delegated by the board?
Because we've already decided that if the terms or conditions are met.
And if it's met, then it looks, I believe the board could delegate that to you.
But we can, I think we can go ahead and vote on this one.
This one is on the agenda, so we should vote on this one.
To close, or to lift the state suspension. So moved.
Second.
Okay, so we have a motion from Mr. Everroad, and second, we're going to put it with Ms. Bycott.
One point.
Yeah. Any additional discussion? I will make one point. So I have no problem lifting the suspension or the state probation, but I wish our agreement had had some technical remediation, because it was a serious technical issue. And I don't know if he's learned what he needed to learn in 4 months. He might have met all the terms that we imposed, but I don't know if he learned everything he needed to learn. So, but I think that's on us and not him. So,
and you were there when we wrote it.
I was there and I didn't say anything because Jason was probably telling me.
Move it along.
So, I'm good
it's
with
good,
it.
Good to look at lessons learned.
Yeah, I think it's a lesson learned for the future. If there's an issue with technical skill, we should have a provision for that. Okay. Any additional discussion? Okay. If not, we'll vote on the motion to release Mr. Andrews from his agreement, or to say he's complied and release him from his state suspension.
Aye.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. Does that complete your cases, Mr. Hunt?
Yes, thank you for doing that early. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Next, I think we have a phone call with 7A.
Yes.
We might as well do that before, I think he's in Michigan, right?
He's available if you guys need to speak with him. I don't know if you wanted to. He just said he'd make himself available for you. So if you want to...
I personally would like to speak with him if he's available.
Okay.
Okay. Just a moment.
Hi, Mr. Piquel. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. This is Alejandro Angel. I'm the chairman of the board, and we're in the board meeting. We're ready to address your agenda item, which is 7A. This is your application for registration. In your application, you disclose a criminal history. You were arrested in 2004 and convicted of operating a vehicle intoxicated, and then hit a tree on your way home. Then the following year, in 2005, you were again arrested for operating a vehicle intoxicated. This time, you were charged with a felony as your driving resulted in a fatality. You serve your prison time and been discharged. So we wanted to bring you into the meeting and give you an opportunity to explain, you know, your actions and why you think you should be allowed the privilege of being registered in Arizona.
Since I've served the time, it was in prison and been released, did my time through parole, and was able to be released from parole, and I've done what I needed to do to stay sober, and been as much as I could practiced and stayed active as practicing engineering after I found a job shortly after I was released on parole. The company did go out of business, and I was able to find another job that I was able to maintain for a year and a half before I was let go from there. And then I've been employed for a little over 3 years now, in the engineering business. I've stayed sober that time.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Piquel?
Mr. Piquel, this is Jason Foose. I'm just curious, all of your current licenses are in good standing?
Yes, they are.
Have you ever had any discipline from a board related to engineering practice?
No, I have not.
Thank you.
Mr. Piquel, a question for me. What's your reasoning for wanting to be registered in Arizona?
I think the company, I was requested by my company to get registered in Arizona. I think they believe they might have some upcoming work there. Our company does a lot of work with CVS, not always just new stores, but a lot of renovations. We also have an office in California that sometimes handles some work throughout on the western side of the country. So they believe that's probably likely that they might have some work there that they might need me to perform and review on that side of the country. So that's why they wanted me to get licensed in Arizona.
Any other questions or discussion from the board?
No, I think I...
Okay. How about the board members? Anything you'd like to know or...
I think I see another a date typo, and it says in October 2015 he was arrested, but then he was done with parole in 2011. When was the...
2005.
2005, okay. So that's a whole lot farther in the rear. Okay. Thank you.
Any discussion? I'll speak for myself then. I know this is a tough decision, but I'm not in favor of registering Mr. Pickell. I think, you know, what he did showed very poor judgment, and that's one of the things we have to trust in engineers. 1 year after having, you know, an infraction for this already and ending up hitting a tree, he goes out and does the same thing again, you know, passes out while driving 60 miles away from where he should be and kills someone. And to be honest, I don't hear the remorse in his voice the way I'd like to. So to me, all that goes back to judgment and character. So I can't vote for him. But I respect whatever everybody else wants to do.
I kind of agree with that. I think the severity of the felony is doesn't get any worse than that. If it was something less, then that'd be a different story. But that's
one life that can't have back. So I think, you know, actions have consequences in my mind.
And he had a precursor event that should have altered his character and behavior with respect to driving while intoxicated, and it did not.
Correct.
It is difficult because he's gone through everything. He's done everything correct since that point in time. But to get to that point in time was a big error.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that's the reason we have, you know, rules and laws, and you comply with them, and you never give anybody a second chance ever. I mean, what's the point?
Said, I know this is an issue where everybody's going to have different thoughts, and I understand them. I think his second chance was after hitting the tree. What?
He did his time, and it's been a number of years. Are you in a program right now? How are you managing your problem?
I attended AA for quite a while. I do still occasionally attend meetings with some, but it was the meetings I attended were at an older or former location, and they were convenient to get to, and I became, you know, friendly with the people there. So I live somewhere else now, and so I occasionally go back to visit and attend AA meetings, but it's not on anything like a regular basis.
It's tough. More than 10 years ago, that's... People change over 10 years. When I saw it was 2015, I knew what I was going to vote today, but that's a little harder when it's 2005.
Yep. So I don't know. If anybody has a motion, we can take up a motion and see how it comes out.
I move that we approve his application.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion from Mr. Foose with a second from Mr. Everode to approve Mr. Pickell's application. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. Okay, so I think motion passes 6-3.
I may have coughed over that announcement. Sorry.
Mr. Pickell, you're, the board approved your application on a 6-3 vote. Yeah, the no votes were Montgomery, Angel, and Noel.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, and hope you make the best of this.
All right, thank you. I will.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Seems like we have a few people who are here for at least one other item. So we'll take up 6D1. This is P18064. Respondent is Helmut Hack, RLS 32226. In April of this year, DeBoer received a complaint alleging that respondent ignored physical evidence that indicated how parcels were split originally and rejected monuments without an explanation while conducting a survey in Buckeye, Arizona. We do have, you know, the assessments from the assessors. We have the EAC report, and the recommendation from the from staff is to offer a consent agreement with a letter of reprimand, probation of registration, corrected survey, filing of a corrected survey, administrative penalty of $500, and the cost of investigation of $580. So that's a summary of the case. Would would you please identify yourselves for the board, Mr. Kramer and Mr. Hack?
My name is Helmut Hack.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hack, for being here. Mr. Hack, is there anything you'd like to say to the board?
Well, I would like to read a couple of pages here, if I may. I disagree with the consent order. I believe I protected my client and the public. I think there's a discrepancy in the terms of original surveyor, which does not apply here. But I would like to read this if I could. Should it take?
Absolutely.
Okay.
As long as it's less than 20 pages.
Well, there's a 100-page document. Gentlemen of the board, the following is an answer to issues presented in the consent agreement and order of discipline issued on 10-16-18 by Doug. Finding of facts, consent agreement. The respondent rejected substantial physical evidence, the preponderance of which suggests the boundary line was set by the original surveyor. The term original surveyor is synonymous with the deputy surveyor who contract with instructions, monumented the public land survey system. After turning in his plats and field notes, they were reviewed for accuracy of instructions and for possible fraud. Once approved by the director of the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, they became unchangeable by an act of Congress. This rule of law was created on behalf of the government system to expedite the sales of land without constant court hearings over errors made in the laying out of the public lands. The principles laid out in the manual of instructions protects the actions of the deputy surveyor's work and is the framework that local surveyors must adhere to. Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition, defines original as being first. So appropriately, the first surveyor, Stanley C. Pello, LS 10344, mistakenly identified as the original surveyor in the complaint, created multiple one-acre parcels between the years 1997 and 1999, a creation commonly called Wildcat subdivisions. They are not under the review of local jurisdictions, in this case, Maricopa County. Parcels 1 through 3, as shown on my survey, was created by the first surveyor in book 434, page 41. Excuse me. Preparing and performing the survey, following the footsteps. In the deed, 2005-15-44-868, for parcel 2, book 748, page 30 of my survey, the deed states, a portion of lot 15, Valencia Heights, according to book 21 of maps, page 21 or 31, records of Maricopa County. The deed being the original intent of the grantor, see Olson versus Jude, page 10, number 50 and 51, which is in this booklet here, provides the instructions to the surveyor that he must locate lot 15 before he proceeds with the next step of the deed. Analysis of the plat, Valencia Heights, book 2131, shows a constant bearing from the west quarter to the east quarter and a constant bearing from the south quarter to the north quarter of the section. The intersection of these two lines represents the theoretical center of section. This indicates that Valencia Heights was divided into four quarters. Lot 15 is located in the northeast quarter of section 32, township 2 north, range 2 west. Note, the creator of Valencia Heights divided the subdivision to correspond to Elkwood parcels. Lot 15 can also be described as the west half of the east half or the south half of the northeast quarter of section 32, township 2 north, range 2 west of the Gila and Salt River Meridian, Maricopa County, Arizona, except the south 30 feet for roadway purposes. This is fully a sectionalized land breakdown up to the perimeter of lot 15. The center of section shown on the plat, and that's Valencia Heights, indicates an iron pipe was set and was found and accepted instead of the cotton picker spindle, which is shown on, I have an exhibit here.
And Mr. Hack, I think we have some of the materials you're referring to in our packet. I mean, we have the whole thing in our packet.
You do?
Yes, we do have.
Oh, you do have.
Okay. Yeah, we have.
On the exhibit.
About 70 pages on it.
Yeah. Exhibit 1 demonstrates the iron pipe is, in fact, the monument as stated on Valencia Heights. And that was used in the McDot GDAX system. Which located 80% of all sections in Maricopa County. Using the dimensions on Valencia Heights puts the iron pipe almost 2 feet north of the theoretical center of section. It's pretty much proof that the iron pipe was in fact set in 1929 at the time of Valencia Heights. The alleger and the first surveyor used a cotton picker spindle, which is 2 feet south of the iron pipe. Let's see.
One question for you, Mr. Hack. I think one of the things I noticed is you made your own decisions on what monuments to accept, but you didn't explain why you rejected some of the monuments that you found in the field. And isn't that something that should be on your survey?
It's common practice. You know, what I showed as being 1 foot south, not accepted, is common practice among surveyors. I mean, I would virtually have to take this whole book and create another page and record it to really go into depth. But surveyors are expected to analyze before they go out and perform the work. And if you go out there with the deed and you lay it out on the ground and you find something that's a foot off, it just doesn't fit the deed. That's acceptable, and it's been a long practice.
Okay.
So
let me see if there's any discussion from the board before, because we might have specific questions for you, Mr. Hack, if that's okay. Does anybody have questions or comments on this case?
Well, I'd like to make a few comments here, and I want to start at the very, I guess, the end or the top or the finale here, the findings of fact. The findings of fact, number 4 on page 3 of the consent order, says that the respondent rejected substantial physical evidence, the preponderance of which suggests the boundary line was set by the original surveyor, and then it references Arizona Boundary Survey Minimum Standards Number 4. Boundary Minimum Standards Number 4 says, a land surveyor shall search for evidence that could affect the location and or placement of boundary lines and property corners of the subject property. And he did that. He showed that on his survey. He called them off to some extent, 2 feet or something, some distance. So I don't think that this consent agreement, or the findings of fact, rather, match that concern at all. I mean, they're two different things when I read them. The second item on the findings of fact was the respondent did not state on the map the reason for rejecting points. And they cite Minimum Boundary Standard 8A, which says, if a land surveyor rejects an existing monument, the land surveyor shall create a result that discloses the evidence and shall explain in detail the reason for not accepting the monument. And as Mr. Hack pointed out, it's common practice to use measurements to express that. And that's supported by whatever deeds or research that he included in that to say that this doesn't fit the measurements, so it's 2 feet north. That's pretty common throughout the United States.
But you think he clearly explained why he rejected the other ones by just showing that they were not on his line?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Well, then I have a question, Jason. I mean, obviously, with the pre-existing monuments and the surveys that were generated since the 1929 time frame of the original monument set, wouldn't property disputes all now be, you know, have to be re-adjudicated if you start moving the monuments around and the deeds are no longer accurate off those original monuments?
Well, if you consider that the alleger came in after the respondent, the alleger is actually creating that upset. So, speaking of the alleger, let's go back to the notes on his plat. And the reason I'm doing this is to express the amount of uncertainty on the ground and the subjective nature of both of these opinions. And when I see both of these opinions, I think they're equally valid. We have a 50-50 shot of one of them being right and one of them being wrong, and or one of them being better than the other, maybe is the way to say that. But when I look at the alleger's notes, for example, he says, therefore it was presumed that all of the air was in the north closing line and accordingly adjusted. So he has this presumption of something. And then he goes on to say, for the purposes of this survey, the center of section was assumed at a cotton spindle only because it creates a basis of bearing similar to the original survey. It should not be assumed that this survey has determined that it is the center of section 32. So he's basing his whole argument on some tentative statement that he's trying to almost disclaim here. And I'm not sure how or why any of that fits, but I think that the public's looking for one point on the ground and somebody to say this is it or this isn't it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of subjective opinion in this complaint, and I don't think that the respondent has failed in the minimum standards. I think he meets the minimum standards and the standards of practice. So what I see is a difference of opinion, and based on that, I'm going to move that we just dismiss the case.
Okay, we have a motion.
I'll second that.
And a second. So let's discuss the motion, unless there's nobody. Do I have an opinion? Jason and I have talked about this. I am not a surveyor, so I'm not going to venture to say who's right and who's wrong specifically, but I place a lot of weight on what the EAC said. Mm-hmm. And we had three surveyors there on the EAC, plus one person who did one of the reviews who was not on the EAC, one of the assessments, but was not on the EAC, and they all substantiated the same claims. So I think our difference is, I don't think it's 50-50. I think the majority of surveyors would say that there are some issues. So that's my concern.
And I get to the point, though, that those concerns are based on the opinion. They're not based on the technical standards or the things that were called out in the findings of fact. I mean, the findings of fact are, in my opinion, wrong. They're just inaccurate.
What about the original survey? Does that go back? What's the bearing of that relative to this position?
The original survey would control, and we have two surveyors that have different renditions of what the original survey was. One of them, the alleger in his survey, actually disclaims that he doesn't know. So I'm not sure, or at least that's how I read his statements. I'm not sure that there's a strong foundation to...
The first pin was done in 1929.
29.
Is that the iron?
According to Mr.
Hack. Mr. Hack, yeah.
That wouldn't take precedent over...
Well, that would be the controlling, the feature.
If it is the 1929 monument.
Yeah, if he can tie it to that, and his opinion is that what he found is the evidence of that original survey. So that's Mr. Hack's opinion. I respect that as much as I respect the alleger's opinion, too. For whatever reason, they come up to a difference. They come up with a difference of opinion. But I don't see where Mr. Hack failed to meet the minimum standards or perform a technically deficient survey. I think his professional opinion is just different. There was some correspondence where the two had discussed some things, and you can see there's contention between them.
Yeah, I read that.
But I don't know what the solution to that is. But if you look at it chronologically, Mr. Hack was there first. So I don't know that another surveyor coming in and reinventing the wheel is the best scenario here for anybody. But again, that's just an opinion. That would be a third opinion on top of the two others. So
realistically, Mr. Hack could reverse the charge. And the guy that came after him is wrong.
Well, I think part of this is not so much about being right or wrong, in my mind. I think there could be some discrepancies in that, but I think part of it is, how do we interpret the minimum standards? I mean,
I believe that Mr. Hack met the minimum standards. I firmly believe that.
Okay, and I guess my point is, the EAC didn't think he met the minimum standards on explaining why he rejected certain points.
And again, as I read the minimum standards, they don't say what the EAC said in the findings of fact.
What it does say, you have to clearly explain why you rejected the monument.
And it's clear. I mean, I can't find a better way to express that a monument's out of tolerance, for example, than a precise measurement of, 2 point whatever feet in a direction. So that's pretty elementary surveying stuff. So.
But not for the four guys who looked at it and the AC.
Well, I mean, look what they wrote. I mean, the EAC had trouble expressing that somehow. And I don't know. I mean, their explanation in the findings of fact doesn't even match the minimum standards. They say two different things.
The first item. Yeah. Mr. Hack, did you have something you want to add?
Yeah. There's a survey that I looked at from the alleger. On his survey, he states, being the original survey and all parcels have been sold based on that survey, their positions are unalterable. I have a case here, Olson versus Jew, that was decided, was appealed, and it basically says, the deed is what controls. That is the intent of the grantor. If the surveyor places it in the wrong position, those monuments do not control.
Okay.
And that's what is in this case here. They used the wrong monument. They violated the owner, because the owner faces a possibility that they will not get permits for that property because it falls short of the acre of land.
Okay.
How big a difference was the change?
About 2 feet.
Two feet.
Yeah.
But when you, Jason, imply that looking at the survey arguments, the alleger and the respondent, that they're 50-50, I mean, I kind of, on, you know, from an engineering perspective, want to look at, you know, I'll use a legal term, the preponderance of evidence. Are there a substantial equal number of calculations that prove the monument sets are both valid, or does one have more veracity than the other? And you're saying that it doesn't.
But I can't answer that right now. I didn't go out and survey it. But both of those surveyors can, and they formulated their own opinions.
Well, it's a difference of professional opinion is what it amounts to.
Yes. Both of their surveys meet the standards of care for reporting.
I would object to that.
As you, Mr. Know. Webster.
Are you talking about yours or the...
No.
Because we're talking about yours, really.
Lot 15 needs to be located. On my survey, it shows I located the northeast quarter and I located the full lot 15. The alleger basically pulled up to the address and just looked for monuments. He did nothing else to help prove his numbers. I mean, he fell short in what he did.
We can have more discussion on this one, too, but I'm not sure that...
There's a motion on the floor.
Absolutely, yeah. Is there any more discussion, or should we vote on the motion?
Did someone second it?
Yes, I think Mr. Noel seconded it. Okay, I think we can vote on the motion. My explanation is I think when we have such a big discrepancy between the EAC and, you know, our board members, maybe we ought to send it back to the EAC or do something along those lines as opposed to just dismiss the case. Because it's, you know, they've invested a lot of time looking at it, and I think we ought to better understand why they did that as opposed to just tossing it out.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
also,
Mr. Donnell?
If I may just quickly before the board takes a vote, I don't think it's going to impact the board's decision at all. But just for the record, I believe the Olson v. Jude case that the gentleman cited is actually a Montana case and isn't
Arizona.
It pertains to sectionalized land, and it would be helpful.
Okay. It could be helpful.
It can be referenced in a court.
Well, certainly it could be helpful, but it's not controlling the Arizona case.
Well, the statutes
for
states that we follow the Bureau of Land Management manual.
Mr. Hack, I understand, but I think it's not Arizona case law is what Mr. Donald's trying to say, which I think is relevant to know that it's not an Arizona case.
Can I say one more thing about the, I guess it's the AEC, the five members? I tried bringing some of this information in, and they rejected it. So it was like I couldn't even give a presentation of this information.
Okay, that's concerning.
And they ridiculed something, you know, the book. And it states in the Montana that it is a well-respected book. That's Brown's Legal Principles of Common Control. Well-respected in that court. And it's well-respected because that's basically what the exams are based on, is that book. And the AEC rejected that book and made fun and said, oh, I've got the book, you know. So, you know, it was disappointing.
Thank you, Mr. Hacks. Yeah. Okay. I think the motion on the floor.
Well, I know it is, but sending it back to EAC, and I know you have concerns with the findings of fact don't match anything that anybody said in the EAC. So, I mean, maybe this does have to go back and get, at the very least, reworked so that it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. That would be...
Because I think...
Yeah, you know, because if the findings of fact aren't, if the EAC says one thing, then the findings of fact are coming out with something completely different.
Well, I don't think that's the disconnect. I think the disconnect is at the EAC where they are coming up with a different interpretation of the minimum standards. Maybe a personal standard or something, but I think that the staff reflected the EAC's comments well. from the EAC. And we've got the report in here. We can look at it.
I think the comment made more along the lines, Jason, that if we on the board have a different standard of how we want to see things or how we interpret things versus how the EAC interprets it, it makes no sense to keep having differences of opinion. It might be better to just go back to EAC, talk, and figure out where the difference is, and can we come up with an agreed-upon solution?
I think that goes back to the written minimum standards. I'm not sure that the EAC's thoughts are consistent with those standards. And, I mean, it's in plain writing here in this.
Could I offer a suggestion? Is it possible that an alternate panel be convened?
Yes.
To independently review the evidence and see where the preponderance of evidence lies rather than just issue it as a difference of professional opinion at this point?
Right. Yeah, I think Moses says yes, but I think I would like to have you, if you're available, Jason, to participate in that.
The problem would be he would then need to recuse.
He'd have to recuse himself when it comes up. But, you know, I think to Jason's point would be, to tag on to yours, would be the EAC needs to look at this of, here is a set of, just like we do for home inspectors, here's a set of minimum standards. Does this survey, whether you agree with it or not, you know, does the boundary survey meet, you know, the minimum standards? Because like you said, two people can have two different opinions, mm-hmm. and still follow the exact, you know, two people can have the exact same, follow the exact same set of rules and come up with two different opinions. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, but, you know, if one person does it, follows all the rules, and the other guy skips four steps and comes up with a different opinion, well, then that's, you know, not correct. But, you know, I don't see any problem with having two different opinions. I mean, you can have two different opinions on a lot of different things. So, you know, I think maybe if they do a new EAC, that has to kind of, you know, staff has to direct them. You need to just look at this just, you know, I'm just not with your opinions or how you would do it, you know, because I know that comes into, you know, oh, I would do this different. Well, all of us do stuff different, you know, differently for different things. It's just they need to actually look and follow, does it follow the actual procedure that's in place?
And certainly if you do vote to send this back, concerns that have been addressed, not just by Mr. Foose, but by, you know, the board as a whole can be
part of the public record and sent
right.
to the committee.
By the EAC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And staff who's sitting in on it would understand.
Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the B fact, the second fact of rejecting the points, not explaining the objection, the committee thought that that he should have enumerated or should have stated that on there, you know, in verbiage, whether Mr. Foose was under the opinion that it's sufficient to do it in numbers. The committee thought it should have been written on there. So I think it's the same information is just expressed in different ways. And so, I mean, they struggled with both of these allegations, and at the end, then it was, well, he didn't say so, you know, in words. Where
okay.
Mr. Foose said it's numbers.
And maybe having the case go back now, they can address whether they believe that, you know, just showing it off the line is sufficient explanation or whether something needs to be in writing or what the common practice is.
What the minimum standard is.
Right, and that would be the point. You know, like Mr. Kramer said, they don't express it in words, but Mr. Foose says it's expressed in numbers. So I guess the question to them would be, can you interpret why this happened just based on what's here? You know, can you make a determination based on what's here, why that pin is in the wrong spot? And I think if the answer to that is, well, yes, it's because the numbers all work out this way, then that's a legitimate way to do it. It might not be the way they would do it, but it's still a legitimate way to do it.
Okay.
So do we still want to vote on
it? No, I want to strike down the motion that's on the floor now, the second was to dismiss the case.
Okay. Wasn't the second Mr. Noel?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second. We should vote on the motion
right.
at this point.
Unless Mr. Foose wants to pull it.
I'd be happy to withdraw that motion.
Okay.
Okay. We have a second without a motion.
Who else not pulling?
Good job.
No way.
Okay. Do we have a motion to send this to review for review to a new EAC?
So moved, Chair.
I'll second that.
Okay.
When you said new, is that different people?
Different people. EAC. If you had different EAC to and specifically address the points brought up by the board and Mr. Kloos today,
yes,
and how they relate to this case. So we have a motion by Mr. Gilmer, seconded by Mr. Montgomery. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Heck. Appreciate your time.
Great. I guess, what is the next step now?
So the next step is we convene a different panel of surveyors to review the case and specifically look at the discussion we had today.
Okay.
Your explanation.
We'll also have this review?
You
can give it to Mr. Kramer. You will have the opportunity to explain it at the meeting if you want to participate. I know you put a lot of time into this already.
12 months.
I appreciate your time.
I'm tired of it.
I understand.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
You.
Okay. Is there anybody else here to speak on a specific case that we should hear first before we go back to the beginning? Okay, not hearing anybody. How about we start with the dismissal cases? Is there a motion to consolidate them,
Mr. Chair, Johnson? I'd like to move that we consent 6A1, 6A2, and 6A3.
I'd have to take exception, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I just have a concern on 6A2. The firm that Von Darling, his letterhead is using the term architecture. And I had the question as to whether or not that can be in the business letterhead of the company, that should be.
Okay. So I think maybe we take that one separately to discuss it. Mr. Jones, did you want to consolidate 6A1 and 6A3?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that's for consent and dismissal?
Yes.
Okay. So that's a motion to consent and dismiss 6A1 and 6A3 by Mr. Jones. Is there a second?
Second.
Second from Mr. Poos. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. So, give me 1 second here to catch up. We will move to 6A2. This is the case of Ron Darling, P-19-012. He's a non-registrant in Scottsdale, and this is about a project at Coral Gables Drive in Phoenix. And we have the synopsis of the plan. I think what it came down on the basics of the case was that the alleger said the respondent had represented himself as an architect, but then when confronted, he said he actually didn't hear it from him. He heard it from a third party, and we were never able to talk to the third party to confirm what the respondent had identified himself as, Mr. Darling. So I don't know, is there anything else that we should discuss, Will?
Well, that's a good summary of the
okay. Very cool. And then, Mr. Montgomery, you had some concerns.
Yeah, no, I just had some concern. I guess on our document package, I addressed the board to look at page 85 of the PDF mm-hmm. file. And there you'll see in his proposal, he's using the logo Darling Designs Residential Architecture and Interiors. I'm just concerned about, you know, if he used the word, you know, interior designer or design interiors, I would have no objection to it. But it seems to lend the implication that he's going to provide architectural services.
Yeah, I read the same thing and had the same question in my mind, is why is he saying architecture if he's not doing it?
If he's not.
It is residential architecture is what he's saying. He's not mm-hmm. claiming to do other architecture, so I don't know if that's an issue of itself in itself or not.
before. I know we've had this discussion.
Yeah. What do we decide, Jason?
I don't remember.
There are licensed architects who specialize in residential work, so I think in the past we have said you can't use it if you're not licensed.
That's cannot it. Use it.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Seems
yeah.
That'd be cool. He should be changing his letterhead.
I wonder if his registrant's working for him. And would that change?
The firm is not registered.
If so, then the firm should be registered as well.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I guess, I think we've had the same discussion for the numerous years I've been here.
Too many.
Is architecture.
Seven and a half.
Is architecture. Yeah, I know. Is architecture a protected term? I mean, it's architecture. I mean, you know, it's.
It may mislead the public into thinking he can do architecture.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
But he says
look at the buildings, you're looking at the architecture. I mean, I don't know. I mean, seriously.
But lay people don't know that distinction.
Yeah.
Well, the public.
Yeah, I don't think they know that distinction. I think if somebody got a business card or LinkedIn said the same thing when I looked at it, it says, you know, Darling Design, Residential Architecture, Interior Design, they might think they're dealing with an architect.
I would.
Yeah.
My mom would. Mm-hmm. Just random person, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've only been here 4 months, but we've been very consistent about no engineering, no architecture in the title, no, like, it seems like at the very least a letter that says change out your letterhead or something.
I think the construct really is that it's protection for the public, okay? Not for us. I mean, knowledgeable users, but public who might Google this, and this may come up as a firm that provides architecture if you did a search on that term.
I think what we could do potentially, so he's not a registrant, so we couldn't just send him a letter and, you know, of concern, but we could do a fairly lenient consent agreement where we said, you know, yes, you didn't use the term, you didn't call yourself an architect, or we couldn't establish that. What we did establish that your firm used the name architecture. Please, assure us of discontinuance. No fees, no anything else. Just
assurance of discontinuance.
Get rid of the name of the word architecture in your firm name.
Through a consent decree, though? I mean, is that...
We could offer him a consent.
And that doesn't trigger discipline?
So... He calls himself an architect on
his... So we can't send him a letter of concern or anything.
Right, we could send him... I mean, a consent could be discontinuance plus a fine and investigation fees. That could be... that would be our typical concern, consent. If we think this one is more gray, we could eliminate some of the fees but still keep the assurance of discontinuance so he gets rid of the name or the word architecture in his title or firm name.
Darling Design and Architecture on Hughes says that he's a traditionally trained architect, and unusually for an architect, he has firsthand knowledge of construction methods.
Where are you reading from?
H-O-U-Z-Z.
Okay. The only challenge we have with that is that...
Architecture and Design with the same logo?
That's not in the docket, though.
Right.
I apologize.
Put on a spot or it's just we have to make sure that all the board has the same information.
I think...
We could send it back for inclusion of additional information and contacting this respondent to see if he might willingly correct the problem or perhaps come in and answer more questions. What do you think? Sounds good.
It sounds good. I need to understand the process.
Okay.
What would we do, Melissa?
We would... table this case and allow Mr. Will to contact the respondent, maybe look on H-O-U-Z-Z so everyone can see what the advertisements are, or LinkedIn or whatever.
And find out whether those advertisements are paid and prepared by the firm or by third parties, because we've had that where somebody says, well, I didn't do that. It was just something they picked up.
So we could sort of end this until the next meeting, pending further investigation to determine if there's probable cause to actually open an investigation.
Okay.
Do they need to vote to do that?
Okay.
Okay. So staff has that direction. Anything else you want to include?
So we don't need to take any action. We're just going to table it?
Yeah. We'll let Mr. Will look into some additional evidence.
Okay. Everybody okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we are done with the 6A's. We will move to the 6B's. And I will say I had concerns with one of the, or three cases. Oh yeah, 6B2 is the one that I'd like to have a quick discussion on.
Agreed.
You have an issue with three?
No, okay. Two. I agree with two. I agree with you.
Pulling out two.
Two.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
What?
Oh.
I know.
It's going to cost you another couple of years.
Okay, so we'll pull two. Does anybody have issues with, or does one? Anybody want to consent one and three?
I move that we consent 6B, 1 and 3, and issue letters of concern appropriately.
Okay. We have a motion on the table. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? So that was Foose motion and Montgomery second.
No.
Sorry.
No.
Gilmore.
It's Friday words, buddy.
Yeah. Didn't mean to insult either one of you.
And that was one and three?
Correct.
Okay. Yes, that was B1 and B3. So we'll now go with 6B2, case number P19006, Henry Krisik, architect, and this is referencing a non-registrant firm. Basically what it boils down to is Mr. Krisik is a registered architect, but his firm is not registered. He's been practicing without firm registration for 24 years. And his contention is he didn't know he needed to be registered. Is that about it?
Yes, he reiterated several times that he has been constantly registered and paid his annual registration fee for many years. And it wasn't until it was brought to his attention by me that he needed a firm, and he needed a firm registration, that he turned around and did just that.
Okay, so he did register his firm. He adamantly said that he shouldn't face any discipline because he didn't know.
Okay. He said he was a sole proprietor and didn't know that he also needed a firm registration.
Okay. So Jason, do you want to...
I don't see the difference between this one and C.1 and C.2.
Is that there, well, the only difference is this one has been going on for longer.
Well, except for that.
And you know, it's 24 years of not registering the firm. I don't know what that amounts in fees, but it's, you know, well over $500 and other stuff. Plus, not that, Jason, but in the past, when somebody hasn't registered a firm, we've been fairly consistent in doing a letter of reprimand and a small fine. I think we've done $150 or $250, something like that.
Yeah, we're doing a letter of reprimand or just a letter of concern?
Right now, we're doing a letter of concern and no fines.
No. I mean, what are we doing on these other ones?
Oh, letter of reprimand. We did letters of reprimand. Yeah. I think $250 in one and $500 on the other.
Yeah. And that was time difference on
those.
It was
a time difference. Yes. Sir.
Right. Yeah. And that makes sense. I mean, obviously 24 years. You know,
wow.
But I say it at least has to be $500. We have to be consistent with these things. You know, just because you say, I didn't know, too bad. I mean,
yeah.
You know, that's your responsibility as a registrant to know the laws and follow them. So,
and what I meant by adding the fees, Jason, was that if he had registered his firm, he probably would have paid more than what he will pay now in the fine. So anybody who would have kept his firm registered,
that's not my concern. If I read this right, his firm name is his name, and that I see as a distinguishing feature of this case. But I do agree with Mr. Madison. need to know the rules, and if you have a firm, and if it's H.J. Kurzick Incorporated or something, well, that's different than his individual self. But it's the fact that he goes by his name sticks out in my mind as something unique. He's not Sunshine Architecture or Cactus Architecture. So,
but it's still a company.
It is.
Yeah, I was going to ask for that clarification. I mean, there are things called professional corporations, you know, LLCs, etc. When you say a sole proprietorship, it's misleading. Do you mean that you are not incorporating the entity that's performing the business for its liabilities and insurability and protections apart from yourself? Or are you taking all that on personally when you say that this is a sole proprietorship? And then it gets commingled. If the firm is not a separate and distinct entity from the individual practitioner, then I think we're blurring the lines.
Well, I think he kind of falls into a blurry spot. When you think of something small like a PLLC, I mean, people do this out of their house all the time. So,
but it's a separate entity.
But it's still a company.
It's still a separate entity.
There's not a driving force of, this is some firm that's going to be disassociated with the name. The guy's name is his firm. If you want to throw a brick through his window, you look his name up and drive by and throw a brick through his window. So you can make a direct association
don't
with
do
the guy.
That.
I wouldn't recommend that. But I mean, my point is that he's very strongly associating this with himself. Again, that doesn't justify not knowing the rules or any of that.
He's a sole proprietor.
But you can understand how he...
Is he? Is he incorporated? Is he a S-corp? Is he a sole proprietor?
I don't
He's
know
a sole
that.
Proprietor. He takes all the liability on himself.
Yeah. The guy on 6E1, his name is Randall Jacob. His firm name is Randall Jacob Design. So a lot of those guys are small.
Most of the architects, we know that. Most are one person
firms. You should change the name of your firm to Sunshine Architecture.
Maybe. But again, I go around.
That's the only point I want to make, is this guy is under the assumption that it's him. And he's
but
I don't think that's how the rules read.
No, it's not. You're correct.
And at the very least, he could have called him past.
Yep,
read the
yep.
rules, called Mask.
No
hey, I'm my own guy. Do I need to do it? Staff would have told him yes, because this has come up a lot. So,
again, we talked about this last year, either newsletter or somehow, how do we get the message out there that practitioners need to register themselves as a firm? I talk to AIA people all the time. You guys, you got to do this. Most of them don't know. They just don't.
And I think it's been in the newsletter.
It has.
Yeah.
It's
on the website.
Just keep,
we
yeah. keep
we
doing
do have an item on the agenda license. To talk about principles and firm registrations. Maybe if we do make a decision on that, while we publish that in the newsletter, we also cover the issue of, you do need to register, even if you're a sole proprietor, you need to register.
I think it's on the website, too, isn't it?
It is.
Sure, Nessa, maybe in the AIA newsletter, maybe you guys could say something, too. They read that more than they read our newsletter.
Yeah,
really?
Sure.
Can they check a box when they're licensed or registered?
All right.
We could do that.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah.
Yeah. On the
or
on a renewal.
Yeah, or on your renewal or something. Just have a note that says, "Please be advised that if you're your firm, the firm that you work for, even if you're a sole practitioner, needs to be registered as a firm with the board under, ARS da 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 da," and then.
They have to be separate forms, though, because firm registration is an annual thing, and architect and professional registration is a three-year.
So at least maybe in bold.
Yeah.
The reminder.
Yeah, they'll see it one day.
And with their grant letters, maybe put something at the bottom. Reminding them of
check
that
it
law.
Because they get it, they essentially get it in bold in the newsletter.
So
you almost want them to acknowledge it somehow.
But
even one time in the initial... individual and firm.
You're right. And then,
that's it.
It's a stronger piece of evidence for noncompliance.
Sure.
Afterwards. Mm-hmm. But gentlemen, ladies, that the pleasure of being licensed requires your knowledge of the law that regulates your profession. So, if we...
Understood.
Yeah.
Are you really?
But we'd rather not have those people come here and, but they something like a checkbox on the on the individual application or renewal that says, by signing this application, I understand that, you know, my firm needs to be registered under Arizona statute, whatever.
Right under
even if you're sole proprietor.
Even if you're sole proprietor. Underlined, bold, everything, yeah.
Or work for Sunshine.
Yeah.
I'm working for Mr. Jones.
Over me.
So
but if you're an employee, though, of DLR, for example, that, mm-hmm. you're not going to check that box, right? Is that box be on every architect's? Mm-hmm. It doesn't apply
right.
to a lot of people.
The statute, you just have to read the statute. It says all private firms or whatever. It doesn't say, you know, if you work for a private firm, your firm needs to be registered.
I understand if I'm a sole practitioner, I need to register my firm.
Yeah. Could be on all the applications.
So in the meantime, I appreciate this gentleman rectified things very quickly, but if we're giving out $500 penalties to everybody else, I don't, it would be tough to say this 24 years of it didn't account for $25 or $500.
Mm-hmm. That almost sounds like a motion.
Almost.
Very poorly worded, yes. I move that staff reconsider a letter of reprimand and a typical penalty of $500.
Yeah, and do we want to offer that consent?
So we have to offer that consent.
Yeah, to the registrant. Think you can make it as
$10 a year.
Yes.
That
yes,
we offer. Please. Okay. Offer consent with letter of reprimand of $500 penalty. Cost of investigation or no cost of investigation?
I don't know how much.
You say no.
How much could it be?
You can leave it out. That's fine.
Yeah, let's leave it out.
Okay.
And then, Karen, did you also mean to say that if he doesn't sign within 30 days, we'll send it to hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
That's
exactly what you were going to say. Yeah. Okay.
Go work for Mr. Jones.
Yeah.
Second,
they don't sign.
Okay, we have...
good one.
Not sign within 30 days, go work for Mr. Jones.
Mr. Foos.
Sunshine Arc.
Is the second.
Sunshine Jones.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Letter of reprimand, $500 penalty, no cost of investigation. If not signed in 30 days, forward to hearing. So, all in favor of the motion?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. We're going to go to the 6Cs.
I have to pull number 2 because I have to recuse myself from that one.
Who's with the unlucky number today?
I know.
Okay.
6C2?
Yeah.
We just need one moment over here.
Yeah. I'll take any break I can get.
He just wants more clients. I mean, it's no big deal. It's just that we've reached out to him, but he is one of our current clients.
Like 2 liters of half a gallon.
Yeah,
it's
coffee
in here.
No, it's a problem.
Never mind.
It's small.
Yeah. Oh, it's a two.
Well, we update on the minute side. Does anybody have any other cases on 6C that you want to take up individually? Jason already mentioned Madison, 6C2.
Mr. Chairman, my question is, you know, and I just was writing myself some notes on it. Are we using a sliding scale on this lapsing in firm registration? I mean, 250 on C2, 500 on C1. I understand the time periods involved, but is it just the instance that causes the penalty, or does time become a factor in determining it? And, you know, we just went now through B2, which was the most egregious back in 1994. So what is our standard on this, what I'm trying to, is there consistency?
So our standard, I will say we've been very consistent in two things. One, we typically do a letter of reprimand.
Yes.
And two, we do a small penalty of $500 or less. Within those bounds, I think we've been very consistent. We've actually applied smaller penalties, for instance, in a time when
the board system, for whatever reason, wasn't sending reminders of firm registration. So people, yes, people should know the rules, but we weren't sending the reminders, so I think we imposed $150 penalties instead of... Besides that, I don't know how we came up with the $250 versus $500.
Yeah, I think the kind of the way I look at it, it's $250 if it's a one-cycle thing.
Okay.
You know, like you forgot, you know, or,
right.
You know,
and
forget for 3 or 4 years in a row, okay, you know, you get to a point where you're just kind of not doing it. Especially people that, the weird ones are the ones, okay, I think between these two cases, is the one, they were both registered at one time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One missed like one cycle,
right.
And the other guy missed like four cycles.
Yes.
It's like, well, but you were registered at one time.
Right.
So, you know, what's your excuse for missing that many cycles? So
okay.
That's kind of the way I look at it.
So long as we can justify
the
difference. Yes, okay.
Okay, so we're pulling 6C2 out. Does anybody want to take up C1 and C3
I'll make a motion to consent C1, C3, and accept signed consent agreements.
I'll second. All right. So we have Mr. Madison and Mr. Jones second on the motion. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion passes. We will next go to... Agenda item 6C2, case P19-005.
I'm recusing myself.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Madison. You might need to get your form.
I already did.
Okay, all right, good. Thank you, Will. So this is the respondent is Jose Ceja, registered architect with XR Architects, and the issue is a firm practicing board-regulated profession without registration by the board. And the recommendation is, the signed consent is a $250 administrative penalty and cost of investigation for $145. And is there no letter of reprimand on this one? I guess not. So forget what we said 5 minutes ago. Eugene. Being consistent.
Not mine. I can't keep up.
All right.
Socks
on tight. Thank you.
I think I got the 250 right, though.
You did.
Okay.
So that's the consent we have in front of us, and I think we've offered it, and he signed it.
Sure, I'd like to make a motion. We accept 6C2, the consent agreement.
Second. Okay. We have a motion by Mr. Gilmer, second by Mr. Everode. Any discussion? We'll vote then. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Jason, 6E is next, isn't it? I think we did all the D's?
Yeah, 6E1.
Okay. Just checking. Okay, next is 6E1, case number HI-19011, Thomas Sullivan Home Inspector, and this is in regard to a home inspection in Gull Canyon, Arizona. On a letter from October 29th, Mr. Sullivan requested that he receive only an administrative reprimand with no fine or fees. So that would modify our original consent for a reprimand $500 and $104 cost of investigation. Is there any thing we should know?
No, that was Mr. Sullivan's whole contention, was that he shouldn't be assessed any fees. His basis of his argument was the original complaint that was brought was subsequently, that charge was subsequently dismissed, but his firm registration was still expired.
Okay.
That was expired just for 1 year? Just
right.
Over a year?
Yeah.
So does that go to the lower number then? So instead of $500, should it be $250?
Yeah.
It's consistent.
Yeah. My only question is, I mean, we offered him this consent in October? Yeah, October 23rd. And we had knowledge of all these things. So, I mean, I think it's not like any new facts have come to light since we offered him the consent. So should we revisit it? I guess sometimes we do modify them.
I'm inclined to just stand on what we have. So I will move that we stand on what we have.
Second. Okay, so we have a motion from Mr. Foos and a second from Mr. Jones to continue to offer the consent agreement that the board approved in October. And if not signed...
In 30 days, proceed to formal.
Okay. Excellent. If you want a piece of
this. Okay. Okay. How long was he not registered for? Just over a year?
1 year.
So I don't know. I see a problem with this. You know, not offering him, because we just have a case on this exact same agenda for basically the exact same time frame for $250. So that's just my two cents on that.
But if I remember correctly, the complaint was withdrawn, but I don't think that they found his report without fault. The AC.
Correct. The inspector that worked for this firm was given a letter of concern from Mr. Chiarella. And this firm registration was expired 7/31/17, and the home inspection was done March 2018, and it was just brought back into compliance recently. So it's been a little more than a year that he's been out.
I guess let me look at his consent. I mean, was the findings a fact that he didn't conduct it?
No, because this is he's the principal registrant for the firm, I believe.
Right.
The guy who did the actual inspection got a letter of concern.
Oh, okay.
For his
So this is just the firm. This is not against the same guy. Okay.
Correct.
So this is straight firm registration.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we should offer a new one for $250, but.
Well, I'll withdraw my motion if you want to make one.
Yeah, I'll make a motion that we offer a new consent agreement, the letter reprimand, civil penalty of $250 and cost of investigation, not paid within 30 days, formal hearing.
Second.
Okay. So the motion is from Mr. Madison, second from Mr. Gilmore. We'll vote on the motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes.
7B.
We will go to 7B now. This is Brian Urey, application for registration as civil engineer 182382. Mr. Urey, I think misinterpreted some of the experience credit on his application, and as a result needs an extra year to get the experience he needs to get registered. So he's asking for an extension on his application for another year.
Or from the date he filed it.
Thank you. From the date he filed it. So the board recommendation is to grant an extension until October 1st of 19.
Oh.
Next year. We're almost there.
Okay.
Like 3 weeks out.
And you're still retired.
I move that we grant Mr. Urey's request.
Second.
Okay. And can we say specifically until when? When do we going to give him
whatever he
is? 3/20.
Following October 3 of 18.
That's what our statute says.
So we can only grant him 1 year. Okay. So we're extending until October 3rd of 2019. Is what the motion is?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Second.
So motion, Mr. Everode, second by Mr. Foos.
Question,
Mr. Knopf.
In the engineering application, did you not get any credit for a master's degree?
Yeah, so the issue was, the rule says you get credit if, or the statute, if it's in the same branch that you're seeking registration.
Right.
And he's looking for civil, but his master's was in petroleum engineering.
Right. Okay.
Okay. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion passes. Who wants to take up 8A? So next we're going to go to the 8s. License and consent agenda.
Wait a second. Super some names.
Yeah, make sure you're not in it?
Yep.
Yes.
It's like all alarm agents.
Yeah.
5 home inspectors at the end. Is that industry that big?
What's that?
These guys do this every year, though? Is that why they're always on here?
I think so. Yeah.
There's a lot of people doing this.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion to cancel registrations or certifications that have been expired for one full year, as shown in packet AA1.
I'll second Mr. Madison.
Yeah.
So we have a motion from Mr. Madison, a second from Angel.
You allowed to do that?
What?
You allowed to do
I
that?
I can do seconds. I can't make motions. This is what Melissa told me.
Melissa.
Right, Melissa?
Yep.
Okay. So all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. We will go to 9A. Proposed board meeting dates.
Wait a second. I'm supposed to see that for...
That's okay. Just for review. We don't have to take action on 2. Just when we cancel people, but... Okay. Just for information.
Just make sure your name's not on that list.
Check the farm every month.
Every month.
Unless it's sneaky.
We just watch out for you.
We're going to put his in. We have to.
Can I
just slide it in there.
The last one? I did. Thank
it's
you.
Funny.
Jack Gilmore.
Who?
So 9A is the board meeting dates for 2019. Is the fourth Tuesday of every month except for December.
November.
Which is, well... December is earlier. November, there's no meeting.
Correct. No meeting. Just make sure you all pencil it in, because you'll probably...
I'll be here. We'll staff send out an email with all the new dates, please.
You want what?
An email with all the new dates.
We will.
Oh, it's in here. No, never mind. I'll just use it off this.
Okay.
Okay. 9B. This is the statute of licensure by endorsement.
Yes, this is on really just for your review and comment or question. This is the work product of legislative council. So hopefully it says what we want and it says many other things. Some of which are really good. That Ledge Council, I don't know if you remember, but 2 years ago, based on some errors, we ended up with 2 in-training statutes, both of which were incorrect. So this proposed legislation fixes that. It also takes things out of our title and makes sure that we're not regulating assayers and drug remediation people any longer. And it includes some language that apparently Ledge Council is including in all kinds of legislation about second chances for criminals. And the only thing that's substantively different, I believe, from, well, and then they're adding us and the Department of Agriculture to make sure we, I don't remember why we're added, but...
To the DPS?
Yeah, the DPS.
That's the section of the statute that authorizes certain groups to be clearance cards.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that just refers to the home inspectors because they're elsewhere in this bill.
Right. And then substantively, the home inspector committee met and felt it necessary to add a paragraph to the legislation that requires applicants, regardless of where they are from, to provide a report for their review and to make sure they have requisite experience that's comparable to what we require here, because according to the committee, our standards for home inspection registration are actually higher than they are in other states. So Ledge Council and the sponsor were fine with it. Hattie and I had a very quick but good meeting with Senator Kavanaugh, who I believe now is Representative Kavanaugh, and he said, if you like it, we're good to go. And we said, we like it, and he said, have a nice day, and that was it. It was great.
So he is going to sponsor
it? He is, yes. So I expect this will drop earlier in January than later in the session because it's already drafted. So hopefully between me and Patty, if you have questions, we can answer. Yes.
Regarding the national examination for geologists and home inspectors, do we need to say who takes care of that examination?
I don't think so, because sometimes the organizations do change their names. So.
But there's only one national exam for home inspectors? No, we don't want somebody to take a 30-minute exam off the internet and say it's a national exam.
There's only one national association that offers the home inspector exam. And actually, on the committee now, we have a new member, Paul Starin, who was very involved in writing that exam. So he actually at the last committee meeting provided an interesting update about their attempts to make it psychometrically sound and to do online, CBT kind of testing. So they're taking it very seriously, akin to NCWS and ASBOG.
So we are saying that the ASBOG exam is the exam?
Yes.
Even though it doesn't say ASBOG here?
Right. Okay. But, I mean, if someone else wanted to come up with a national exam and we felt it was equal to or we wanted to accept it, I think we could. It's just no one else has done that. So.
Yeah. I have questions. First of all, I like it a lot. I like that it's a little bit more comprehensive than what we originally envisioned. Mm-hmm. One question is, we changed the qualifications for in-training designation to refer to the fundamentals exam instead of the in-training exam. That's good. But I think we need to do that throughout the statute. In 32.101, all the definitions say, the requirements to be an engineer in training, you need to pass the in-training examination. So that should be changed to say you need to pass the fundamentals examination.
We didn't change that back in...
Maybe I looked at an all set of statutes. So it's 32.101.18.
I know it was the intent back in 2016 that it all get fixed.
Maybe you did, and I had the old one. In which case, you'll remind me.
32.101.18?
Yes. 18 and 22. Yeah.
I think you have an old one, honestly, because 18 is home inspection report.
Okay, what does say 32.101 engineers? Just say in training, engineering training designation. That's the definition portion.
It is the definition, you're right.
And does it say that they need to pass the in training examination or the fundamentals exams?
It does say in training exam, you're right.
Okay, so that's the same for land surveyors and geologists. They all say the in training exam.
Okay.
And I think I also read something on 32.106.A4. They had the same item.
So if we're following it, is that problematic?
No, because we still call them engineer in training, but they're not taking an in-training examination. It's called the fundamentals examination.
But we still offer in-training designation. So for 32.106.A4, it's just a general exams reference for in-training. It maybe should say for in-training designation and professional registration.
Okay. Take a look. I might have been looking at the old one, but I wasn't looking for references to in-training designation. I was looking for references to the in-training examination, which would be fundamental.
No, I see what you're saying.
Again, I'm seeing this throughout here where they've made the change with examination. If that's your concern, I'm not sure.
So they made it on what we're changing. There's other parts of the statutes that don't have that change.
All right, I got you.
Yeah,
it's true. It may not be possible in this session to do that, but I'm gathering a list for LNR to talk about legislation for next year, and we can always add that in.
as a cleanup. I think there's also possibility you can make, put something in the bill that says which council will make all of their conforming changes.
Conforming changes.
So look into that. That's great.
Okay. Perfect.
Patty's been very charming with Ledge Council, so.
That's good.
Somebody yeah. has to be.
Thank you, Patty. Yeah, exactly.
Like I said, we all have Melissa. Our strengths, right? That's why. Yes. Other comments or questions about the bill?
Do we need to take a position, or should we take a position on it, or no?
I don't think it's necessary. I think because we asked for it, our position's pretty well understood, but I just renewed our lobbyist registration, so we will, of course, be going down and following this and whatever other bills come up that we need to watch for. I find it interesting this year as a state agency, a public body needs to spend $25 to register itself and its lobbyists who claim no money for reimbursement for lobbying expenses, but that's just me. It's interesting. Secretary of State's office is getting $25 now from everybody who wants to be a lobbyist.
More justification for consolidation.
I guess. Anyway, so thank you for that. Next month, of course, we'll have legislation as a topic for discussion on the agenda. So if there are other bills you're interested in or we think you should be interested in, we'll definitely have time to talk about that.
But this bill basically clears up registration, right? Professional registration.
What do you mean it clears up?
Well, it seems like it's straightened everything out. There's not good. Is there a geologist in training or what was that term?
There still is a geologist in training, a surveyor in training, and an engineer in training. But there is no more landscape architect in training and no more architect in training because their exams just don't allow for that designation.
Is there still a trained geologist?
There is still a trained geologist.
You could be a geologist in training or a trained geologist.
Wow.
Yes. We have no jurisdiction over those trained geologists.
Yeah.
In training.
All right.
But I think the biggest positives of this bill are, one, we'll be able to grant licenses much easier to somebody who has the same qualifications that we require here. You can do it actually taking action, right, instead of bringing it to the board?
Yes.
And then secondly, it cleans up some of the exam exceptions. Before we had that, anybody with a license from any state or country could get licensed without an examination. So people could come from any country and say, you know, I get my license when I graduate from college, so I should get my license.
Correct.
That's a different standard than we use, so we wanted to. That's taken out, and now it's got to be state or U.S. territory to get that benefit
Correct.
Of the exam waiver.
Correct. Let's hope it goes well.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Do we want to go to 9C then?
Sure.
This is Home Inspectors Committee recommendation that the board change the designation of home inspectors from occupation to profession.
This is on at the request of the committee and the home inspectors who attended. They would like to be referred to as a profession rather than as an occupation. And I don't know why they were originally designated an occupation. It could just have been language we inherited when we inherited them in 2000 when the bill was voted on and approved by the legislature to require registration. So,
what are the implications of being called one or the other? Does it affect anything?
Does a profession indicate
education?
A degree and occupation doesn't? Is that
I,
what it's
I think so.
Is that what
I mean,
it is?
If you look
I think
at,
it's very much perception.
Yeah. Yeah. It's perception. I think legally there's really no difference between calling someone a profession and an occupation. I think we have adopted it here in defense of professions that are the three-legged stool. You've got the education, the experience, and the exam. But home inspectors also have required education. Of course, it's only 84 hours, but it is required education. They do take a national exam, and our 30 parallels are an experience requirement. So it's here for you to discuss.
So do we officially call it something somewhere, and that's why we need to take it up, or is it just about...
I think on our website we distinguish. We refer to home inspectors and alarms as the occupations that we regulate. So, and then the big five professions. So it's easy enough to fix.
I'm of the why not on this one.
Yeah. I think you should recognize exactly what Melissa pointed out, that unlike other occupations, they actually have to achieve education and experience and examination. So there is a bar, which I think might be set with a profession.
Okay. I see all those points. My only concern, the why not argument would be, if we say they're a profession, are we coming to the legislature or to other people with the perception that we're trying to make things more difficult or more relevant than they should be? You know, are they going to lump everybody together and say, see, you guys make professions this, 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 and this are all professions based on you because you want to keep people out? I don't know if that has any weight or not. I can see a case where somebody would say, you know, just like 2 years ago when they lumped you know, landscape architects with fruit pickers and, you know, yoga instructors and...
But they're doing it regardless of what we say about them, you know, regardless of how we distinguish. And...
Yeah, I don't think the occupations are flying under the radar.
No, they're not. And when occupations are discussed even nationally and certainly among the states, engineers and architects are right in there referred to as occupations, not professions.
Yeah.
So... Yeah.
You meet somebody, say, what's your occupation?
You don't scratch that out, right? Professional.
He says retired engineer.
I just say retired. an associative issue. I mean, elevating them, if you want.
Yeah,
characterize it to a profession. Do they warrant membership on the board, or is there any board recognition further than just the name change that this entails?
They have also considered the issue of requesting a seat on the board, and I've done my best to explain why that shouldn't happen and why when we started regulating them, we have a committee for them that liaises with the board by membership of public member and the forever serving Jason Madison. And the committee itself is okay with that. They feel that things function really well. They love being under our board. They appreciate that they're only 3% of our licensed population and make up 35% of our enforcement actions. But there has been discussion because the question was posed by a member of their occupation / profession. So, I think, you know, to give Ron his credit, when this was added to the board in 2000, I think he clearly understood that the engineers and the architects and the big five would not be welcoming of a position, a home inspector position, since there isn't that working dynamic between that group of licensees and the big five. So, you know, it's like reverse engineering. You guys can understand the home inspection issues that are presented to you with help from the committee, but it would be difficult for a home inspector to understand the complexity of the science and design issues that you discuss here.
Melissa, for a while you were trying to move out alarm agents and home inspectors. Is that still on?
That is always ongoing, Jack, because I believe in government efficiency. But no one has taken up my gauntlet for me. I do mention it, like I answer almost monthly complaints that the governor's office gets from our licensees. And they're always thrilled with how well the cases are resolved and what we're doing to serve the public. And then at the end of everything I send in here, and should home inspectors prefer to go to Department of Real Estate, the board would be happy with that, you know, something like that all the time. There might be a better place to regulate these various occupations and professions, and we are forever open to discussing that.
Melissa, are other states, assuming that they control the discipline home inspectors in a regulatory manner, where do they reside in other states?
It's interesting because alarm agents, for the most part, reside with our DPS equivalent, which is really where I think they should have gone here initially.
Yeah.
There is new leadership at DPS. We might be able to revisit the issue with them now. You might remember in 2016, before we went through sunset, the lobbyists and I went over to DPS and they were not in a position to accept alarms, but that may have changed. And home inspectors, I personally think the Department of Real Estate would be a great fit for them. They don't want to be regulated by Department of Real Estate.
What about ROC?
ROC, we met with ROC recently to discuss computer stuff, and they don't see them as contractors, and they don't see their occupation / profession as something that's required by statute to be performed. So I don't think they would welcome them as part of their license population. Although many home inspectors are contractors, mm-hmm. they do share dual registrations. So we'll see. I mean, at least we're talking to people, and it may be the bad thing about home inspectors versus alarms, if there is a bad thing, is that they don't support themselves as a regulated group. The alarm industry does. They bring in enough money to support their portion of our operational expenses. Clearly home inspectors do not, and for an agency to take that on willingly, I mean, if someone came to me and said, here, have the home inspectors, you'll have to subsidize them times five, I'd say no. But you know, there's still an argument to be made.
Can you increase their yearly fee?
We can certainly discuss that.
Seems fair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh. I think you have the justification for it, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We certainly do now.
We're getting a little beyond what the scope of this agenda item is. So.
Right. So what do you guys want to do? Do you want
to
call?
Do we need to take a vote, or do you want to just do it?
I think they would appreciate it. Yes.
And we would need a motion.
Go ahead.
I'll move that we call them a profession rather than an occupation. That will move.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion by Ms. Wyckoff, second by Everroad. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
Nay.
Now that they're a profession, can I put on the agenda the idea of raising their fees?
You can put it on the next, at the end of the meeting, we have items for next board meeting. That's a great item for next meeting. Okay, next item on the agenda, 9D.
It also relates to the home inspectors. Some housekeeping at their request, and that is to rescind substantive policy statement number 8 because they believe the new rules that went into effect in August removes the need for the policy.
Does it?
I never want to say yes with 100% clarity, but Scott, what do you think?
So this was the preferred vendor policy, right?
Correct.
Where they couldn't get any kickbacks or any other thing, compensation for recommending certain professionals.
Correct.
I mean, is it in conflict with the new rules, or is
no,
it just kind of supplement
much
to the new rules?
Reiterating the new rules, so.
Right. So that, I mean, I don't know what the new rules say specifically about it.
It pretty much says that. Let me see.
And as you know, I have an old copy.
I'd be inclined to say if there's no direct conflict apparent, let's let it sit for a while and kind of gel and see what happens.
Okay. I don't like my new rule book.
Who's buzzing?
It's your ear.
What's going on?
I just have to look at all the rules because I'm not sure where they put it in. Yeah. Okay, so it's R430-301.01B. And it says, certified home inspectors shall not pay directly or indirectly in full or in part a commission or compensation as a referral or finder's fee. Two, perform or offer to perform for an additional fee or have any financial interest in the performance of any repairs to the property that's been inspected by that inspector or by that inspector's firm for a period of 24 months following the inspection. And then three, be accompanied by more than four home inspector candidates while conducting any parallel home inspection. So the substantive policy statement, in my opinion, mirrors this, and if you want to wait to take action on that as they requested, that's fine by staff.
But, I see their point, and after hearing the statement, I think it does say the same thing. The rule says the same thing as the policy we have. So I'm comfortable if that's what they want to do, going that way.
I also recognize Jason's point that it might be good to wait for 6 months and see if we get any new complaints or, I don't know.
If we did get new complaints, would we adjudicate them based on this absence policy or the rule?
On the rule.
We would go with the rule.
Correct. You're so practical.
I even learned how to say adjudicate.
You know?
I mean, it doesn't hurt to keep it in there. I mean, it's not hurting.
Okay, well,
bad.
You're going to have to explain that at the next inspection meeting.
That's what I'll tell them. Doesn't hurt.
All right, doesn't hurt.
As long as they don't say two different things and someone can construe them as two different things, what's the difference?
Okay. Thank you.
Nine E, compliance and monitoring policy regarding extensions of time for respondents to comply with disciplinary orders. So the whole policy is in there?
The whole policy is in there for you to see, and basically what it does is it mirrors authority that staff has or doesn't have regarding what happens after the board votes to put somebody on a consent agreement. Maybe Doug wants to provide a little background.
Sure. So the reason why this policy is, well, this is a working policy. This is an updated version of the policy that we've been working on. So I guess what we're going to ask the board to consider is whether or not you want to grant staff or Melissa the authority in certain circumstances, such as the lifting of a stay of suspension when there's a non-compliance issue without having to take the case back to the board and ask you to do it. That's one issue. The other issue would be, from time to time, we get requests from our respondents who are under consent agreements to, due to a hardship, ask for an extension in paying, you know, a fine or a fee. And again, if the board wishes to grant staff the authority to, or Melissa the authority to, you know, give them a 30-day extension, nothing excessive, if there's a demonstrated hardship, then we could do it and be a little bit more efficient.
That sums up, I think, the issue before you, but you should know that I've gotten an ombudsman's question about this as it related to an enforcement action regarding the payment of restitution to an alleger. Apparently, the alleger was concerned that the respondent wasn't paying the restitution in a timely manner, but, or according to the letter of the law in the order. But the respondent had been in touch with the investigator at issue and had explained a hardship. And the investigator tried to intercede between the two parties to facilitate the payment of restitution timely. And that apparently did not happen, or didn't happen the way that the alleger wanted, so she contacted the ombudsman. And that really made us focus on this and whether I currently, and through me, staff have the authority to not change a board order, but to consider hardship circumstances, try to facilitate payment of restitution timely, or should we stick to the letter of the law, which says bring it back for a non-compliance case consideration at the next board meeting. You know, administratively that's tedious, but I don't want to advise the board to do that if we don't have the legal authority to do so.
Sure, and this also ties into one of the things we were talking about earlier in this meeting with the lifting the stay. And I would say that the board has a certain amount of an ability to delegate authority to Melissa. What it's going to come down to legally, from my standpoint, is going to be sort of a question of what type of authority is being delegated. If it's a positive authority, I don't think there's ever going to be a problem. And by that I mean somebody submits all paperwork on time, then a positive action happens. You get your license back, or your application is granted. That, I don't think, is ever going to be a problem. The question is going to come down to discretionary decisions. So if, for example, somebody has a D&O with a requirement that they pay the board $250 by March 1st, and then if so, then the D&O would be terminated, I think that absolutely the board would have the ability different areas where the board can grant the authority for Melissa to be able to lift that at that point, because it's a verifiable fact that $250 checks received on a certain day. There's no real question of fact. If it's something that involves actual fact-finding to determine if there's been compliance, I would be more careful. Because that really comes down to the board making a decision. If it's something that's not really easily quantifiable that way. So it's going to come down to the question of what kind of authority is being delegated. I would say best case scenario would be to kind of get an idea right now of what the board would like to delegate. And you can certainly do some delegation currently to address current needs. Additionally, have perhaps law review committee look at a long-term fix under rules to delegate specific authority so that there's no question statutorily. But in the meantime, I think there's certainly statutory authority for the board to be able to delegate some limited powers. In the event of a D&O, it's a much easier call. The board also, in the D&O, in different terms and probationary terms, I think would be able to have as a probationary term, upon completion of A, B, and C, the executive director may terminate the probation or terminate the suspension. In other types of situations, it's really going to come down to the
D&O.
Decision in order. I'm sorry.
Decision
in order. I'm sorry. A consent order, a decision.
Discipline.
Yes, disciplinary order as well, actually. So it's really going to come down to what is the board is authorizing Melissa and potentially by extension her staff to do. When it comes to something like an extension of time, I think the board can authorize Melissa to grant a reasonable extension of time, and there are a couple of arguments I would make for this. One would be that the board has the authority to do anything necessary to promote the mission of the board, and there's very much of an efficiency interest in this. Another one would be if it's a hardship issue, it may be too late to wait for a board meeting for something to be handled. There may have to be a decision about whether to grant an extension, or the guy may have to sell his car to be able to make a payment on time. So it may come down to a critical issue of Melissa being able to make that decision. So I think there are very strong reasons why the board could grant that authority in this circumstance. I would just want the board to be careful to enunciate very clearly on the record what authority they're granting. And again, I would keep it very quantifiable terms, or in the case of something like an extension of time, make it something like granting Melissa the authority to grant an extension of time no later than the next board meeting. That way the board would then, it would automatically come back to the board ultimately for decision, but you would be able to grant an extension of time until that meeting for the person to be in compliance. Any questions about that?
I
think we should grant you the authority. I think we all recognize we have a very skilled staff here that can make prudent decisions, trustworthy, and if there's something that comes up that you think you need to talk to us about, I think you would do that. So I don't think there'd be any abuse of authority in this way at all.
Thank you. And you could always revisit this decision. And should circumstances require that?
Because my question is, are there any improvements we can make to the policy right now based on what Mr. Donald said, or that we should make before we adopt it? And I don't know.
Well, this is an internal policy, so you don't have to adopt it. It was just here as reference. And we will certainly make necessary modifications and follow, you know, what the board votes to do in this regard.
Okay. The other item I saw in there is possibility of referring cases to the AG for collections.
Yes.
Okay. And is that something that we want to do?
Yeah,
I'm
we
fine
do
with
that.
It. Okay.
We already do that.
Okay. Never mind.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
And I don't see an issue with the things like the thing with lifting the stay. I mean, it's written right in the order. So basically, if you comply with this, you know your stay can be lifted. Okay. I mean, if they comply in a timely manner and they're not 6 months late or something like that. That's
well, you
fine.
Realize lifting the stay means to impose the suspension or revocation.
Well, okay.
And that
dismissing the
yeah,
stay.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Right.
Removing it.
Okay. Right.
Yes.
I'm
going to be issuing.
And I like Scott's thought of if you're going to grant an extension, it should just be to the next board meeting when the next board meets.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not, you know, oh, I feel sorry for you.
You get 6 more months.
I'll give you another year.
Right.
No. I mean, you know, it should be, you have, you know, 3 weeks or 4 weeks, that's it. And then the decision can be made if you want to issue a new,
revised agreement or, yeah.
Right, advise it or issue a new
revise
one.
Revise our board orders to include some of this.
Yeah, it might be something that maybe staff and I might get the next board meeting some language that then the board can approve if this is the direction the board wants to look at. We can then help with some language.
Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll put language together. We'll start including it in our proposed consent agreement, relevant to consent agreements, and then give you the language to consider at January's meeting. Sound good?
Okay.
Good
too.
Okay.
I have one quick question, Melissa. Right now our staff is really the perfect staff to execute this well. Is there something you could add in there that would force the board or let's say a successive executor to
hint, hint.
Revisit this. to say it doesn't extend past
you. You can at any time revisit this. This is not something that officially transfers any board duty, obligation, responsibility, authority to an executive director if there is a change in leadership.
Can we limit it to you? I mean, it, and I mean that as a compliment, really.
Thank you.
I mean, you and your staff are really the people that can make this work, as Neil pointed out. But if something changed, if the governor
right.
winked wrong or something, if something changed, we might get stuck with
then
clown shoes underneath us saying, hey, we're doing this.
I see the point in that a board 5 years from now won't think about this.
Right.
So if you left 5 years from now,
Jason will still be here. He'll remember.
Said all that.
Or maybe just revisit it.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, I think they could revisit it at any time.
And what the board could also do would be to simply make it an annual provisional grant of authority. Then every December it gets.
That'd be good.
That's
holiday party.
That'd be perfect, yeah.
The holiday party, exactly.
You want to do what?
Okay. And it'll be on, it could be on every January agenda for subsequent board meetings.
Okay.
As long as Madison's here.
I'll be here. Yeah, put that in the rule, too.
To ask Jason Madison, play name.
Okay, well, thank you for having the discussion with us, because the Ombudsman did want to follow up with me about this delegation issue and how the board felt about it. Of course, I had told him we were also conferring with legal counsel, and so I'm sure this will make him happy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I think we're close to the end of the agenda. There's actually pretty meaty stuff that we have to deal with. So why don't we take a 9-minute break until 11:30.
Okay.
11:30.
Nine.
And, nine.
Okay.
The meeting of the board back to order. We're going to address item 9F.
Awesome for you.
So this is going to tell us all about principal registration. And I think, I guess, Melissa, one thing I had in my mind as I, this is not your item?
That's why it's perfect.
Yeah.
I did.
Principal registration. So, yeah, no, I think it's great. So if you can introduce that, I think it might be something that could be become a substantive policy at some point to explain what we mean by principle.
That would be great for us, because we have this discussion over and over.
Mm-hmm. So we'll put that on the
I would like to opine that the use of the word principle is misspelled in this context.
You're right.
Architectural principle.
It's a pal. Your principal is
a pal. Principal is a pal.
The principal is your pal.
Yep, that's right.
I don't know how it ended up that way.
You guys went to the right school.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, Andrew did it. That Andrew.
So I think the question is, we know...
what do you think?
Patty, unless you want to explain it, but the statute right now is that principal means, this is the statute, an individual who is an officer of the corporation or is designated by a firm as having full authority and responsible charge of the services offered by the firm. So that's all we have in statute, correct?
And then we have what the firm needs to be registered, which I've given Scott to take a look at. So those are the only two things I could find
that
provide
guidance. Okay. Yeah, firm should not engage in practice unless the firm is registered and the professional services are conducted under the full authority and responsible charge of the principal of the firm, who is also a registrant.
Yes, sir. And when I read that definition, we all went back to it to consult with this agenda item. My question was, does that pertain to legal or technical functions?
I think both is what I interpret it. Because you can't be in responsible charge and not know what's going on technically.
Right.
Well, I know even back in my old in New York State, they actually wanted the principal to actually be a non-practitioner.
because of financial, you know, hedge funds, monies, whatever, whoever had the money was putting the entity together, and they wanted to be the principal party, but it was mostly in a legal capacity. And you know, so you got to take, we just have to take exception to that. It must be a practicing, licensed practitioner, basically. Mm-hmm.
To own a firm.
To own a professional services firm.
That's not what we're talking about here, though. What we're talking about is, for the firm registration, who should be the principal? Right?
It doesn't matter who's
the owner.
Okay.
It can be a minority partner, or it can be somebody that has delegated authority to be in control.
Okay,
that's what I
was confusing
for the statute.
Right. So the owner could be a separate individual.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think it has to be the owner.
It doesn't have to be an owner at all.
It doesn't have to be an owner at all. Okay.
Just who's ever who's in responsible charge for.
Okay, that clears it up.
There's one issue, though, I don't know if you remember, where there were professionals who worked for a firm and were named principal, but had no responsibility for when subs were paid.
Exactly.
And there were a number of complaints some years back that the board was holding that person responsible because they were named principal on complaints about not paying subs on time. And I know that...
That's true. We hammered a guy for that.
That would be that's the intrinsic conflict that's built into pulling out the fiduciary responsibilities from the technical responsibilities.
But I really don't have pity for those guys. I mean, they sign on the firm card as saying, I am the principal of this firm. So they're okay taking, you know, saying they're the principal, and then when it comes time to be responsible, they are not willing to do it?
Mm-hmm.
If you really don't have the authority within your firm, you shouldn't be signing the...
Right. And that's how the board held, ultimately, but there were a number of complaints and sad respondents, because they're like, but I don't write the checks.
You can be a principal of a firm, if that's a title that you want, and you have the qualifications to be a principal, but if you're not a shareholder of the firm, that's the deal.
Yeah.
A shareholder of the firm actually has ownership in the firm.
Right.
So two things right there.
So it's really business. I'll be calling Andy and asking for
business.
But the example was, it's a national firm, the local guy is doing the local work, but national firm is writing the checks, for whatever reason, they didn't do it. So
he might not be a partner.
Honor, what do you guys do? Do you sign yours for Arizona, or does California do it?
No, I sign ours for Arizona. But we do have partners in all the different offices, you know, in most offices. The point is, this says you don't have to be an officer of the corporation, you can be designated by the firm as having full authority. And the truth is, if you're running an office, you know, a different city, and you're deleting that office, you should have the authority to be running things, right?
I agree.
And if not, I mean, if you're responsible for an office and they don't let you do your work, you probably shouldn't be there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What about the issue? I know Patty's intent for this was, like, a mechanical is the principal for the firm, and he's approving structural.
From reading this statute, I think to your questions, I think you should not have an engineer, should not be able to be the principal for an architecture firm,
right?
Or for a geologist firm, or the other way around. But I think it's excessive to require a principal in each branch of engineering within a firm. If there's a firm that does, you know, I don't know, structural and at the same time does civil and other things, I don't think you need a civil, structural, and electrical. I think one person is responsible for the work, because one person is overall responsible for the project in the end anyway. So I think it should be one, in my mind,
and that would
it should be one person per per discipline,
okay.
Not one person per branch of engineering or anything else. So if you're doing engineering, you should have an engineer. If you're doing architecture, you should have an architect.
It was in a different state, but residential architecture a lot of times does the basically structural and stamps it and shows where the outlets go and stamps that. Is that not something that
small,
happens in Arizona?
Small project. You can do.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I would call that engineering.
You
if they're stamping
it. You could do that here.
Okay.
Yeah, if they're
but
stamping
that
it.
Count as engineering?
Look, I don't see a problem with, I mean, I've, if you're signing this, if you're a registrant, and me as an engineer want to own an architecture firm and be the responsible for it, that's my right. I don't, you know, and you're saying you're taking responsibility for it. It you're registering a firm. It's not that everyone in the firm is doing everything correctly. That's not what this is. Each individual registrant in the firm is responsible for their own actions. You're just saying this is a firm and we are capable of doing business. I have a problem with saying, oh, you know, this person can't be in charge of this office. You choose to do it. Same way with our rules, say, I can do mechanical engineering and stamp mechanical engineering drawings with my structural stamp. There's nothing that says I can't. I'd be stupid to do it, but, you know, you can.
No, but you can't do architecture, though, which are, or you can't do landscape architecture, which are structural stamp.
No, I think you can. Can you do cross it, or is it just any profession?
Only incidental to the project.
How do you define that, though?
Right. It's
if it's a project that's 98% structural and it's got two trees, he can probably put a little PVC line to it, but that's...
It's incidental, isn't a definition. And it would have to go for legal interpretation about is the sum total of that small thing incidental, or is it, you know, really part of the...
We should make the observation, to Jason's point, many firms are architectural engineering firms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they do both functionalities. I mean, it appears very common in industry for, you know, an entity to create itself to take under those roles under the same roof.
Mm-hmm.
So you do architectural and engineering work. So who is the principal of that entity? I mean, according to this definition, I need multiple principals.
You have multiple principals. You probably have a president. You probably have a chairman. You have a board of directors, I would think.
But the definition of principal here specifically is someone who has full authority and responsible charge. It doesn't matter if you're actually a principal of the firm or a partner or not. This is that you're either a partner or you've been delegated, even if you're not a partner, authority and responsible charge for the work of the firm. So you can designate anybody in your office if they were actually had the authority to do it.
And they wanted to take on that liability.
Yep.
But why would I want to have multiple licensed registrars? I want, you know, I own a firm, an architectural engineering firm, and I want to register that firm. I don't want to register the engineering portion of it and pay a fee and then register the architect portion and pay a fee.
That's what this is saying. If you register architecture, then you have you can have electrical, mechanical, we can check these boxes, I think. That's what this is saying.
Right, but who says if you check that as an architecture, you can't be an engineer? I mean, a multi-discipline firm.
Yeah.
Why, you know, if you could have a firm that has architecture, engineers, geologists, land surveyors, everything.
Exactly, everything.
So who's the big cheese?
Who is the principal?
And it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're registering a firm. You're just saying that my firm, basically, isn't this just my firm is qualified to do work in Arizona? Yeah. Period.
I think you want to make this business friendly, guys.
Yeah. So what if
you
go the other way?
So, such a hurdle.
I agree.
What if you go completely the other way and you had, you know, an engineer be the only registrant for a firm that's doing landscape architecture? And that's all they do. They only do landscape architecture, but the principal is a civil engineer.
What's the difference?
As long as they hire a landscape architect.
You're signing something saying that my firm is qualified to do this work. It shouldn't matter who owns it.
It could be Big E, Small L.A., right?
Then who stamps it?
Yeah.
The Small L.A. stamps it. But maybe you don't want to make them an officer in the company because you own it and you're running your civil engineering firm, and when there's landscape architecture for the trees on the road, the landscape architect.
They don't have to be an officer of the company. I guess the way I was seeing it is if you were offering, you know, various services, then, you know, if you're doing a building and you have engineers and architects working on it, but it's an architect's seal on the drawings, for all the drawings, then there should be an architectural lead. If it's an engineer seal, it should be an architect lead, an engineer lead, and things like that. But, I don't know, maybe it is okay to have...
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a business decision, too. And I don't know that someone who maybe is a registrant who takes this position without being a partner in the firm is making a wise decision on their own,
right.
Because we can hold them responsible, but I don't know that it's, I don't think we can prohibit it. Right?
I think you can either.
Yeah, I think that's the government getting in the way of a lot of stuff.
Okay.
You don't want to get in the way. I think that's right. what is the operative.
Yeah. Well, this discussion is helpful for us as staff, and what we can do is put this issue on the L&R agenda and maybe write up a substantive policy statement that we can provide for the public to better understand the issue.
So is the decision that any registrant can be principal regardless of the services offered?
It has to be in that particular field.
That's what I'm getting
from
everybody. No, no, I think what I hear DeBoer saying is that you only have to have one person be the principal for a firm, regardless of how many services you provide and regardless of what your registration is.
Okay.
So if you're a home inspector, you can be the principal for an engineering firm.
But if I'm a landscape architect, I can't advertise engineering.
Right.
That's what we're saying.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, yeah.
Well, to take it to an extreme, you're a 50-year-old who's owned your own business and you're a civil engineer, and then you hire a whole bunch of 20-year-olds that are just barely registered in architecture and everything else. Shouldn't you be able to offer all those services without signing these 20-year-olds up to be officers in your company? I mean,
yeah.
It seems like it.
But you don't have to make them officers, though.
Right.
Well, you have to give them the full power to do a lot of stuff. I don't want 20-year-olds doing.
Well,
they are taking. I mean, if they're doing architecture, you're a civil engineer. They are taking.
They are.
They're putting their seal. They're not putting your seal.
But the responsible charge of paying all the subcontractors, and, you know what I mean? Like that. I wouldn't want them.
I understand that part. Yeah, more in the administrative part and the technical part, because I think they should have full power and authority and being responsible in charge of the technical work.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
If they're sealing it.
They do. By sealing it, right?
Yep. So Ed's back there taking notes for L&R.
Okay. Yeah, but see if Scott has any thoughts.
Yeah.
Hi, Scott. On the spot.
Tabula La Rasa. Honestly, it's how the board. It's a matter of interpretation by the board. Board statute. I don't really have any legal interpretation one way or the other. It's how the board is going to be interpreted.
So
well,
I think the majority is that only one principal per firm, as long as it's a registrant, regardless of discipline.
Okay.
The record, I'm not sure about that.
I know. I'm not either.
I think, I mean, we've always had somebody, you know, our lead survey guy in the office be the principal for surveying and an engineer be the lead guy for our engineering services in the office.
I think that's the smarter legal decision. Not that I can give legal advice, but I don't know that our statute is that restrictive.
Yeah, again, with experience, I have seen cases where entities, even created to perform a multitude of functions, I would even go so far as to say including land surveying, engineering, architecture, all under one principal, and in the case I'm thinking the principal was a mechanical engineer. But that was the paperwork that was filed with the state, and, with the law department to create the incorporate, you know, because it was a subsidiary, with all of the language in the incorporation paperwork, that individual was designated, even though he was an employee of a larger company, you know, you get into all this hierarchy. It was the principal with respect to the state of New York for the registration of the firm. And it was just a business decision.
Is that you?
No, it was a coworker of mine. Though.
But the rub is when the corporation doesn't pay the subs in time.
Right. That's the
and this guy here who's responsible didn't have the purse.
And that we've always handled case by case,
yeah.
You know. I mean, in doing the research a few months back on the whole firm registration issue, I think the intent of this board back in 1935 or whenever we started registering firms was just
is
to...
Jason on it already?
was just to be a pure registry, to know where professionals were working just so they could reach them. And I think as the practices evolved over time, I'm not sure our rule and our statute really have evolved with it. You know, it might be something we really should revisit, where we talk about more specifically how we hope firms are registered, or maybe we don't, because those are business, you know, business choices. And
the bottom line is we need to have somebody we can hold responsible. If
exactly.
And if they don't have a registrant responsible, then who do we...
Right.
Well, I think the only reason to have a registrant responsible is so that the board has...
Leverage. Yeah.
Disciplinary action.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can't have, you know, someone off the street be your responsible because you have no authority over that.
Right. And that's why it's a one-year registration as well, because people decide they like one another one year and don't like each other the next year, and new entities are formed, and, you know.
But I would think it's, if it's anybody that's regulated by this board, anybody, they could be the principal registrant because you have someone to go against.
Yeah.
They're the one taking the responsibility for it. So... they don't consult their attorney before they sign the document. But I think the whole point of having a registrant is so that you have some authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that part I think, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll work on some nice language and you'll see it in a few months. Are we ready for the director's
report? We're ready for the director's report, Melissa.
Okay. Unless there are questions on the substantive part of the director's report, I would ask that we enter into executive session to discuss possible litigation and receive legal advice.
Can I stay?
One second. Melissa, before we do that,
okay.
I think Mr. Parliamentary was telling me we have in the ledger here from one of the cases that we already
okay.
dealt with, and he wanted to see if we could reopen the case. Is the board inclined? I think we have to be mindful of time, but we can take 10 minutes and deal with this case, if that's okay. This is at 6B3. So we're going to reopen 6B3 to hear from the alleger.
Sorry.
That's okay. Would you please state your name for the board?
Warren Johnston.
Warren Johnston. Thank you, Mr. Johnston. Did you sign in?
I did.
Okay, thank you. What would you like the board to know about your case?
So it's with regards to home inspections and the home inspectors. And, you know, we hired a home inspector, relied on that home inspector, and he said that on this remodel that the bathtub that had been installed on the second floor was installed properly and in good working condition. Yet the first time we used it, which was my wife washing her feet, no more than 2-3 inches of water. The bathtub drained into the ceiling above the kitchen sink and leaked all over the floor. Now the report I was just told said that our inspector, who said that the bathtub was in great working condition, met the required minimum standards of home inspectors. And I don't see how that could happen. How can you meet a standard when the bathtub was installed improperly? He never put water in the bathtub. He never tested the bathtub in a remodel.
Well, I think we got pictures of him showing water in the bathtub, if I'm not mistaken.
No, you don't, because he never shipped. I'd like to see him, because I asked for those, and he never showed them to us.
Okay. I know we have, and I think you can figure that out with staff. I will tell you, my primary concern with this case, and I know you guys had some hardships, personal hardships outside of this, but it's your word against his, and your claim came in 2 years later, so it's hard for the board to say that it's something he missed at the time of inspection when the claim took 2 years to be put in.
Okay, so the hardships were we were battling, I was battling cancer, had a 16-centimeter tumor in my chest, okay, when we were going through escrow. And we have a bill receipt that shows that we tried to take action within 30 days after closing on the house, that we had a plumber come out and look at it. And he said that he was going to have to rip the floors apart to first determine whether or not there was any water damage. And at that point in time, I had just gotten out of surgery, and I was going into the cancer, second phase of cancer protocol. So, yeah, it was an unfortunate time to have our house brand new, ripped up, when an inspector missed something. So, you know, I'm in a licensed real estate appraiser. I'm a licensed real estate agent in the state of Arizona, and we're required to keep our records for 5 years after the close. During the RTC days, the RTC was able to go back and file claims against appraisers within that five-year period for shoddy work that they did. So regardless of whether or not it was a month, 6 months, or 2 years after it closed, the basis was he did not do the inspection properly. He has not provided me with any pictures that shows water in that bathtub. And I don't know how that can happen when you fill the bathtub with 2 inches of water and it drains into the kitchen sink.
I understand what you're saying. I think I already told you my thoughts, and I think what you said doesn't change it, unfortunately. I'm glad you're doing well, but it doesn't change my my thinking. I'd like to, if others have additional thoughts on this item.
So my last concern, because I've sat through this whole meeting, and I've listened to you debate professional or occupation, should they be with the Department of Real Estate or with us? And I'm telling you that the Department of Real Estate was established to protect the public against schlock real estate agents, not to protect real estate agents from the public. And I'm just telling you that this guy's report, there's no way that he met minimum requirements. And I don't care. I mean, it just can't happen.
I understand your point of view.
I waited 2 years to file a complaint, shouldn't matter. Because that guy's still out there doing home inspections.
We're not trying to protect the home inspector. My point is, how do we know that the issue happened immediately after?
Because I provided you with a bill from a plumber 30 days after we closed saying that it's not installed properly, but I can't do anything until we rip the floors apart and determine whether or not, because they've been sued because they didn't do that inspection. And they did shoddy work, and there was water damage and mold and black mold and all that other stuff. I gave you that.
Yep.
So you do have proof that we contacted somebody and that it was never installed properly.
We have proof that you contacted something. We don't have pictures to see what was happening. We do have his pictures filling up the bathtub. So I don't think, for me, it's very hard to convict somebody based on two different stories without any additional evidence. Me, and I'm speaking for myself, so I'll let everybody else speak and have their say. If they,
do you have the pictures? Can I see those pictures? Are they in your report?
They're in your board packet.
Yes. Because it's just impossible. It's impossible.
Okay.
Can I add something?
Yes.
During the assessment process, two home inspectors, I provided all the information, and they both said that they did not find the allegations with only one minor reporting violation, and that's why I, as staff, said a letter of concern for recommendation.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you also had the opportunity, especially if you're a real estate professional, you had the opportunity to contact him after you noticed the issues. And
I did contact
him. Okay. When did you contact him?
Well,
I know you had difficulty, but it's a phone call or an email.
Right. So my initial response is not to go after anybody. We had a home warranty process, which is also a joke, right?
Did you make a claim to the home warranty?
Oh, absolutely.
And back was, then?
Oh, yeah. Sure. I sure did, and I sent that in, too. We made a claim. We made all of that stuff, and the home warranties are equally a joke. as the home inspectors are. So, you know, I thought, okay, let's go to the licensing committee, the board. These are the professionals that govern this industry. And
all I can tell you is that I'm trying to be impartial and I still don't see the case. And I apologize, you feel differently.
I'd agree with you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Because the other people went up there and looked at this and they didn't see anything else, any other evidence.
Correct.
I sent pictures of our... Okay. I'm sorry.
We are, too.
Yeah, the picture is on page 408 of the packet. And 409.
So is that it? We're done?
Well, we have to take a motion and see how the board feels, if anybody wants to make a motion.
Motion.
If you look at the picture in the bottom right, you can see the reflection of the water.
Let me see. Can I see it?
Please have a seat and we can find what you're looking for.
Sorry. But it would be just easier if you do it. Go over some of these shelves. I just want to make sure it's my data, though.
No.
Understood.
Because it wasn't on the report.
Reflection.
I don't know how it could possibly attack.
Yeah, that's good. Do you don't think it is? Let's go down up to Shadow and Distance here. You know, up this, that way.
So first of all, that's not my data, though. Because that's not the floor we have in the back. Is that the ceiling with the water dripping through it?
Could you use Rob's meter?
That's the water dripping through the ceiling.
Okay. Please have a seat, sir. Does the board want to have any more discussion, or do we want to proceed one way or the other?
I think we closed the case.
Yeah.
We're closed. We're
done.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we have to take another motion, Melissa or Mr. Donald, since we had adopted a letter of concern?
If the board wants to rescind its earlier decision, it would need a motion second and a vote to rescind, and then the board could initiate a new motion if it wanted to from that point.
Does anybody want to initiate a motion to rescind the last motion or the letter of concern? Okay. Hearing none, I think we continue to adopt the decision we had. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thanks.
Okay, Melissa, we're ready for your director's report.
Any questions on anything besides the matter in litigation I'd like to talk to you about?
Where are we now?
We're all 10, right?
10.
Can I ask a question related to, not specifically GL, but our online listing of registrants is completely screwed up.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I don't think that's acceptable.
No, it's
okay.
Not.
Okay. Yeah. What's our plan?
I will tell you about that
executive when we're
session. In executive session.
Okay, can you tell me now when we will have a correct listing of registrants?
I cannot, unfortunately, because we need to go through the SPO process, and that's procurement, and find vendors who this state, not this board, find acceptable to modify our Microsoft 365 dynamic system, which the SPO director, appointee of the governor, believes should be done by Salesforce, the new platform of choice.
Understood, but I think this is a separate issue. I mean, this is just
it
about...
But they don't care.
Hold on, Melissa. If somebody wants to check online, if somebody's registered, we should have an accurate listing. And I think we can, because what I've heard from Kurt is that when something shows up incorrectly, they call him, and he has somewhere the information to know what's correct.
It is in
we
the
We need
end.
To have somebody take that list and make sure it's what's pulling into the website. I don't think it has anything to do with the bigger picture issue. I'll tell you why it's a concern for me is because we're going to get people who are going to come up with it as an excuse for not having firm registration, for having the wrong registration, and I think frankly, it's not acceptable. It's embarrassing for the board if we can't have a correct list.
I agree.
If you give me Kurt's list, I'll update it. I promise.
I know, and we wouldn't ask you to do it. The problem is Kurt doesn't know who is not reporting accurately because the system cleanup is not complete or not complete to our requirements yet. So the only way he's able to make this list is when people call him on a daily basis and say, I'm not reported accurately on your website. Then he's able to go back in and compare what's on the website to what's on the master data, right, Rob?
Correct.
And then he manually updates it.
Okay, I'd like to put this on the next board agenda on a timeline for a solution.
Cool.
Please.
Cool.
And I don't mean to be mean about it.
I mean,
I just think this, I can't tell how many people I heard from, and then I check myself, I'm also showing incorrectly.
Huh.
Yeah.
Are you inactive?
No, I'm
okay.
Active, but it's got the wrong address. So if you're going to send me stuff, I'm not going to get it.
Yeah.
And my registration is up on 1231, by
the
way.
The address of this online is business, I believe, so it will not reflect your residence address.
Well, it's my residential address from 15 years ago when I first got registered. Or 17 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, that's an issue.
It's bad. I mean, there's no two ways about it, gentlemen. And I've been, you can ask staff, hyperventilating and hysterical over this now for the better part of a year since the GL debacle really was underway. And it is all connected because we need to ask permission to use our money. And we have not been getting the approval for that because the young man who is the head of strategic planning and budgeting thinks that we should be using the state solution and not fixing what we have. So, yes, and...
I think we've got to be able to, for the smaller things like this, it's just an outward system. It's not what the system needs to be all consistent, everything else. We need to figure out a way to fix it.
I know.
Through staff or through volunteers?
And
something, if we can't spend money.
And I've been stymied all the way because I'm told we have to go through procurement because it's going to cost more than $25,000. We do not have the final say in what vendor is chosen to do this back-end programming that we need. And our request for budget money of $150,000 to do this fixing will probably not be included in the governor's proposed budget this coming session.
Even more reasons to handle this individually, Melissa. Right. If it's under $24,000, try to handle it individually as opposed to with everything else. I think accurate reporting to the public is important.
I agree. And we'll definitely have it on next month.
If you feed me, I'll volunteer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. And sorry.
No, I mean, it's very upsetting to us as staff because it takes up an inordinate amount of time every day, and we have nothing good to say to the public when they call.
Yeah, it's frankly tough to say, sorry, in 2018, we can't tell you who's registered and who's
right.
not.
We have people saying, I'm not reported as active, and they are. and they may have lost jobs because people go to the website and look. We've gotten all kinds of those concerns, and I've told them as directly as I can to the powers that be, and it's frustrating.
Handle it separately, please. I think let's try to handle it separately from the bigger effort.
Okay.
1986.
Okay. Okay. Yes, and I have been. I promise. But I know.
I know you're trying. Thank you, Melissa, for indulging my...
There's two Neil Joneses.
Okay.
So if we do
I need to ask you a question, so we do have to go into executive session.
Yeah, there's no more questions on the executive...
Okay.
So, do we have a motion to go into executive session from anybody?
So moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Okay, Mr. Everrhodes with Mr. Noel's second.
Bye, Ed.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Right, we do need to vote to go into executive session.
Rob, you might want to stay.
I am.
Okay. Okay. Is it off, Dolly?
Okay.
Sorry.
No, sorry you have to go through that, Melissa. Into open session for the board meeting?
So, as it says...
It's 12:30, so let's move to item 12, standing committee reports. LNR? Nothing to report. Okay. And home inspector rules and standards, I think everybody has the minutes from their last meeting in the packet, and we've already taken action a couple times they brought up. Any other discussion on the Home Inspectors Committee? Okay, 13, Board Member Reports on Outside Activities, ASBOG.
We had a nice meeting up in Monterey. Eric Weiland got an award for doing a good job.
Excellent.
Things went well.
Good. CLARB?
All's quiet.
All's quiet, okay. NCARB?
NCARB's invited Alejandro to dinner at the Biltmore.
And you, though.
And me, but I can't go. I'm going to a different meeting. Rob's going to go to the Biltmore.
Okay.
Because they want to talk about the future architect regulation with Alejandro.
Why would they do
that?
That
makes sense.
He's our board chair.
Do we want to have instead one of our architect members attend?
Busy.
And, you know the date. What date is it? I'm busy.
Yeah.
My back hurts.
And,
so, anyway, that's January 9, I
seriously think, I mean, that would be more appropriate. I can go if you want me to, but...
What?
You know what? I have no background, but
office.
It's right... Yes, it's like I can walk.
Just walk over.
And really, I can walk.
Okay.
So let me know what time it is and prepare me.
Would you be able to forward the invitation to her?
Yes.
Okay.
Based on the laughter, I think I need some preparation.
That's fine, Carly.
It'll be fine. Don't listen to Neil.
The evil laughter has me a little nervous.
The one thing you want to complain about is the Western CARB.
Bring that up.
Make sure you bring that up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Sir, please be quiet. Okay.
And Alejandro has said he's coming with me to the NCWS meeting in Atlanta, right?
Yeah, if I'm still on the board.
February.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
And they sent out a notice. They put out a position statement in support of PE regulation because of that gas explosion that occurred in Massachusetts. So there's a link if you want to read the...
So it's actually interesting, and if you haven't heard it, what happened was the gas company mistook a low-pressure line for a high-pressure line. So when they pumped high-pressure gas into a low-pressure line, it blew up and injured a bunch of people, killed, I think, one or two. The issue was that the person in charge was not a registrant. So not NCES, but the National Transportation Safety Board made a recommendation that Massachusetts require or get rid of the industrial exemption and require people to be registered handling that work. So.
Seriously, you got to start listening to me. The interview's the next day. You may be going to that. San Francisco. You may not be going to Atlanta.
Okay.
Carry on.
He's busy. He's back.
I know, J-Mad. You'd be perfect.
Send me.
Okay.
Okay.
That's it. Future board meetings on January 22nd. Suggested topics for future meeting agendas. I think we had two. What did we have? Carmen, you had something.
Yes, she added my... Oh, increasing the fees for the home inspectors. So
that's what I was... Okay.
Get closer to... Is it possible to bring information on how much...
It costs to...
Cost?
$100,000 they bring in every year, and it costs us $550,000.
Okay, I don't think we'll get...
5.5-time increase in their fees. So now we have a number of what their new fee should be.
Okay. Let's put that on the agenda. And we'll use that money to pay for a fixed database of our registrants. So can we put fixing the list, registrant listing online on our next agenda, please? Any other items for next month's agenda?
Nope, you're going to win.
Just let us know.
If not, does anybody want to move to adjourn the meeting?
So moved.
Thank you.
Okay, move and second from Mr. Noel. So Everett and Noel, all in favor of adjourning?
Aye.
Aye.
Don't even want to ask them.